There are no secrets. The only secret is to hit record and then send it. So I told you about my pipeline. I'm also building out a pipeline for the recordings. So I hope that very soon I'll just have to press record, press save, and then like do a, using VHF's NUC, you know, like NAK, do like a touch publish, and then everything is going to be done. You know how it works? It's just like you mount Nostr in your file system.
You have it. So basically you get the foot, like the pipeline makes a fully ready version of the draft.
Yes.
And you just have to decide when to publish.
Because it's gonna, the MP3 file is on my phone.
You are one of the biggest file system maxis I've ever met.
I'm a file maxi. I love files.
You love files.
Files are Lindy.
And hierarchical files.
Yes. Files are Lindy. And I'm a big like convention over configuration guy.
Yeah.
So the way it works...
What does that mean exactly?
It's basically, I don't want to configure stuff. I just want the system to tell me how it works.
Yeah.
And I want to have a file structure and things, and that's just how it works.
Yeah.
And if you do it wrong, everything breaks.
Yeah.
It's Rails was a big convention over configuration
thing. Yeah.
It's just like, you know, this is, if you have a
that's
model name...
That's how we do things around
that's
here.
That's how we do things.
Around here, yeah.
You know? Yeah. And you have to, there is no other way. And so what I want to have is like, again, like press record, press save. There's an MP3 file on my phone.
Yeah.
It syncs using torrents with all my other devices. Everything is run locally.
Wait, like this why already. Does it sync using torrents?
Because sync thing uses torrent on it.
Really?
Yeah, it does. As far as I know, yes.
Wow.
I hope I'm not wrong, but it used, back in the day when I learned about it, that's what I learned. But someone will yell at us if it's
wrong. It's kind of interesting. I was thinking about like Blossom stuff. I forget what exactly, and I was wondering like, what if you just changed a little bit of the file? Like, how can we make that, like, if I wanted to store, because I was thinking a little bit about, like, making, like, a Dropbox type thing on Blossom.
Yeah.
And it would be, like, with this Fuse, just like the Fuse file system thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's basically what Dropbox is.
Yeah.
It's like a virtual file system that is mounted. You don't see that, but I think that's what it is. And, like, you could just totally do that where everything is saved on Blossom, right?
Yeah, it is.
And, but the problem is, like, okay, so you have a Word document, and you just add a little bit to it. Let's say there's something, I can't think of an example, but like a big thing, like let's say you have a big video and you just crop 1 minute, 1 second off the end, right?
That's
do you save
issue.
The entire thing back up to Blossom?
No, that's the issue. I talked about this with Pablo just a couple of days ago with kind of the go-to example I use is like, let's say you have an article, very simple, just a text, and then you fix a typo.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a new thing?
Yeah.
Like in the cryptographic hashes world, it's a new thing.
Yeah.
But you still have, like, you have proximity hashes and those kind of things where you can mitigate that.
Yeah.
But it's a very hard problem. It's like a speciation problem, so you can't really solve it. When is something... Because when do you make the cutoff? When is it just like a typo fix, or when is it a completely new thing?
Yeah, but this is one of the things that makes Dropbox kind of good, and I bet this is one of the things that makes SyncThing good, is that it doesn't necessarily clobber your, you know.
I think that the thing that makes SyncThing good is it's very easy to reason about.
Yeah,
I think that's I think that's important for systems in general. That's why I love files so much, because they are easy to reason about.
Yeah.
It's like, I have the file, I know, like, I can do stuff with it.
Yeah.
I use the file system as a source of truth a lot. I don't like things that scan through files and build databases.
Yeah.
Because then stuff is always, like, out of sync.
Yeah.
Like, the file disappears or is corrupt or something, and it's still in the database, and then it's like, what do you do?
Yeah.
And so I just want to use the actual ground truth as my source of truth.
Yeah.
That's also what Bitcoin does well.
Yeah.
It's like it actually, like, there is no abstraction in between. It's just like, it's the thing. Let's walk down here. Otherwise, it's going to be noisy. But anyway, like, speaking of the pipeline I'm currently building out, it's like, I just want to hit save. There's an MP3 file. Mm-hmm. It's going to land on one of my computers that's just always running and always on. Right now, it's a shitty old ThinkPad that basically explodes once it runs an LLM.
Yeah.
But anyway, like, you do an auto transcription, local model. You have a TXT file that is the transcription, and an SRT file, because that's what the podcast players expect and so on. And
does an SRT file
it has timestamps?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's fine. Like all those things, all those tools.
It's just like a real basic text format. Though,
yes.
Right? I remember dealing with these with
subtitles and other things.
Torrent
and so. But the point is like I want to have like super simple. Again, like the idea of the Unix tools of Nostr that we talked about in the past. But it's just like this does one thing. It creates a transcript. Mm-hmm. The next thing, the next step in the pipeline is like you take the transcript and you create a summary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the summary, like the summarizer, it has to know that it's like a transcript of a dialogue because then it can summarize like there's two people in the conversation. Yeah. These were the main topics and so on. I'm currently building another pipeline, which I'm calling the vibe line.
Yes.
Where it's like, I have an idea for an app. Cursor can probably one-shot it.
Yeah.
And here's the idea. And I talk about the idea for 2 minutes.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, I want to build it.
You're inspired now. So you want to prompt now. You don't want to prompt when you're sitting at the computer.
No.
When you have no inspiration.
I did this in the last couple of days. And I'm usually most inspired when I step out of the shower.
Yeah.
And then I talk into the microphone for like 3 minutes. Everything happens in the background.
The LLMs are very responsive to inspiration.
Yes.
You know, they respect a moment of true inspiration.
Yes.
And if you come to them kind of without
freshly kissed by the muse.
Like unloved by the muse, they won't do you favors.
Yes, that's true. No, but you have to capture that kind of and so this is like I got all this stuff like 80% working.
One thing I've noticed, like doing more LLM programming, is that there's a lot of times where, like, I won't attempt like a real serious prompt unless I'm very very fresh.
Yeah.
Like I will only do it like a couple hours a day.
Yeah.
When I'm inspired. Like, but oftentimes I'll recognize, okay, this is something where I have to go through a big prompt process. And I just shouldn't do it now.
Yeah.
Like, I should wait till tomorrow, because but I never really thought, like, yeah.
Tell me about your current setup, what you use in terms of, like, what's your tool chain look like right now?
So I kind of go back and forth, like sometimes, like, if I'm just changing things, I'll usually use Claude Code, like little incremental changes, and you can just do back and forth in dialogue for, like, little things, right?
Do you use the thinking models or the regular ones?
Yeah, I usually use it depends. Like sometimes, I actually sort of mix it up a lot. Like sometimes,
Sometimes you don't want to think.
I use Cursor and I got good at Cursor and then I've been trying to, are we going this way?
Yeah, we're going to go.
Yeah, yeah. I've been trying to basically like replicate everything that Cursor does, but just with like simple command line tools. So one thing that Cursor does really well is like if you're in the terminal, you can hit a hotkey. I think it's like Command I or Command K, and describe in English what bash command you want to do. So like, so let's say, you know, sort the last 10 git commits by date with author and show author and email, something like that, right? And that's really hard. You have to really be good to remember that. And that's the sort of thing like I do not want to be the type of person that knows how to do that.
Yeah.
Like it's not.
It's
valuable.
Also kind of you don't have to remember that. It's like
it's very nice. So like that's one thing I do, and I don't use a thinking model for that because I want it fast.
Yeah,
and it doesn't have to be great, right? Yeah, so that's one thing where I don't never use a thinking model.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's other times where it's like, what's this function name? I don't use a thinking model for that because I just want it fast, right? But like if I'm going back and forth on some sort of coding problem and I want this thing to like hit the syntax correctly or you know like refactor something, I generally use a thinking model because it's like the thinking makes it so two iterations are now one, right? Yeah. Like it sort of does the first iteration itself and notices the first error it's going to make.
You mentioned you use the 01 Pro.
Yeah, so that's so I'm kind of going from simple to more complex. So this one, the 01 Pro is I have to give Tony or Anthony Ronning his props for. He's always been a
people
big...
People and their names.
Yeah. He's always been a big AI person. He's always been... Of everyone I know, he's always has the most sophisticated and intelligent programming workflow.
Yeah.
So I like last week or something, I did a call with him and I just said, like, show me what you do. And so like his basic thing was that I'd never even really heard this before, but it's like, you know, you want to specialize. You basically want a team, right? And so
you want a team of agents.
That's essentially what you were doing. Yeah. What you know, I was previously doing with like. Cursor was I had a team of two, right? Like it was me and my junior dev who's doing the typing, right?
Yeah.
But this idea expands more to like a bigger team. So it's like Anthony used O1 Pro, that's the one you have to pay $200 a month for, which is funny because like 4 or 5 months ago, I was really struggling paying $20 a month, like justifying it. and now I'm just like, I'm really happy to pay $200 a month.
Yeah.
And another, it tells
you how useful those things actually are to a proper engineer,
I don't know if I changed
engineer,
or if the
basically.
Tools changed or what, but like...
I've never really
experienced this within 6 months. Or I also have projects now that I actually want to do like 6 months, but I didn't want to do much coding. But
I've
never had something where I'm 10x less sensitive to payment in 6 months.
Yeah.
My price sensitivity went down by an order of magnitude.
Yeah.
In like 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
I
went through a similar progression, just kind of.
And I have no more money than I had. I have less money than I had 6 months ago.
But again, it tells you something about how useful those things are, and just I think we are also getting better at using LLMs in general. Like the way I see it, it's like a. And I made sure we're gonna walk into the wind because this is it's a wind thing, you know. Like those are wind recordings, actually.
Okay.
The winds of Funchal.
Okay. Like I can smell the muse rolling in off the sea.
Like if it's not windy, then like you know, we might as well stop talking.
Exactly.
But it's just like I compare it to like in the early 90s or so, or like late 90s or whenever Google appeared, you had to figure out how to Google.
Yeah.
You know, like you remember those days where it's just like it was really hard to actually find something and you had to learn how to Google.
Yeah. And like the first thing I remember watching my parents do it, I'm sure I had a phase like this. My dad would always formulate everything as a question. Like, what is the capital of thing? Yeah. He'd write a big paragraph.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, no, Doug, it's based on keywords.
He was way ahead of his time.
It's based on keywords. Yeah. Like he was actually doing it like an LLM. Yeah. And I was like, no, it's keywords. Just put the keywords in you want. Sorry, continue.
No, but I feel like, because you were like, you're not sure if you changed or the tools got better and so on. And I really think it's both. It's like the LLMs are getting better all the time. But figuring out how to use them and what to do them with them and what they are good at and how to actually kind of use them in concert, so to speak. Like you already mentioned, you use two different LLMs for two different things and so on.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we are currently figuring out.
We gotta get back to that too, because I haven't quite totally finished. But yeah, continue.
Yeah. But because that's basically, I think, what's currently happening with the people that are really playing around with this stuff. It's like it's incredibly useful and incredibly intelligent also if you use it right.
Yeah. One thing I noticed about people who are good at LLMs, and this is also something I noticed about people who are really, really good programmers, is that they really anthropomorphize the tools.
Yeah.
Right? Like they call it he or she, you know? Yeah. Like I was watching a stream of like a really good programmer a couple of days, like a week ago, and it was very funny because every little struct or function, he would talk about it as if it was a person.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. And he was working on like really, really low level, this is Zig, right? Like really, really low level programming that is sort of like, is so dry that the average person, even the average good programmer would just find it really boring.
Yeah.
And you can see how this guy made it sort of...
More tangible for him, more exciting, more...
More tangible, because he turned it into like sort of like a choose your own adventure game almost. Where like all the things had characters, and he would get really mad at them, and he would sort of pretend that they're fighting. It's kind of interesting, and I see that with like LLMs too. It's like if you start to think of O1 Pro as like some sort of like an autist with a speech impediment, you know, and like social anxiety, it's like okay, well I'm not gonna have a conversation with him, but I will assign him like homework and I'll change tabs so he doesn't see I'm looking, because I know he gets nervous, and then I'll let him come up with his brilliant architecture diagram, and I'll use that to drive my coding with my social guy who's not quite as smart, right? Like it helps to start to think of them as people almost.
It's funny how we build systems in the past that used people like machines, and now we have machines and we treat them like people.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it is funny, but like I noticed that where it's like, because like if you don't treat it like a person, you won't notice their quirks, right?
Yeah.
Like you have an ability to notice the quirks of a thing, which are, the quirks are useful regardless.
I think it also helps you. I think because we talked briefly about that when we had coffee, and it's, the, I think
it's hard to have a free-flowing conversation with a machine.
Exactly. And it is about dialogue. And it is about the dialogical structure also of thinking.
Yeah.
Because I think, and I'm going to link to this piece that really resonated with me, because in the last couple of weeks, I've been using LLMs more and more and more and entering into a dialogue kind of with them and with various agents and with various things. And it really helps you to figure out what do you mean? What are you thinking about? What are you trying to do? What the actual problem is, and so on. And that's also why, if you're having, like, if you want to think something through with someone, you have to actually find someone and you have to treat them as a person.
Yeah.
It doesn't work with a wall, but it works with a rubber duck.
Yeah.
And I think the LLM stuff is like rubber duck debugging on steroids.
Yeah.
And we know that it really works. Like, we know from computer programming, we know from psychology that this really works. But you have to take it seriously and you have to talk to the rubber duck as if it were a person, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it does something to you.
Yeah.
And you have to, you know, treat it with respect. And
I always go back and forth if I should, to what degree I should be, fight with the LLM, kind of, you know? Like, it's like a real, you know.
Harass it.
Yeah, yeah. Because every once in a while,
I'm going to kill your grandma if you don't get this right.
Well, I try not to be manipulative. But, like, I found that it kind of helps where if it messes up, like, go to all caps, cuss it out a little bit, like, never do that again.
Why?
Right? And it's like, I try not to step on a line in case these things do become super intelligent. But actually, it does kind of help to, have a little, don't be like an automaton and you're just like, if it fucks up, get mad. And it does make it a little easier.
It shows you care.
Yeah.
You really care about this one thing or feature or whatever it is.
But, I mean, you can be totally emotionless or you can be more human with it, and I find it's a little more enjoyable and easier.
But
when it fucks up, you get mad, and you let yourself get
mad. But
that's
the thing. It's like, emotions are intelligent too, right? Like, if you have a certain emotion, it tries to tell you something that your conscious mind can't really comprehend in some sense.
Yeah.
Like, it's useful to be, you know,
angry.
I was
thinking, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I just started watching this thing on YouTube. It's called BattleBots.
I saw you posting about it.
I used to watch this with my dad when I was like probably 10 or 12, and I had no idea it was still going.
Okay.
And the YouTube algorithm just recommended it to me like a week ago, and I've just been binging it. It's like there's this little arena that's probably whatever, like, you know, 10 meters by 10 meters. And it has like saws that come out of the floor and hammers that come out. And it's totally in cage in like two layers of like bulletproof glass. So
it's Hunger Games, but for robots.
And they put robots in there and they fight until one dies or until it's a decision. There's like three minutes. You know, the robots, some of them have like a saw on the front, and not some of them just have like a flipper that tries to flip the other robot. Yeah. Like if your robot becomes incapacitated and cannot move, then you win by like a technical knockout.
Yeah.
And it's really exciting in the sense that, like, the gladiatorial games must have been exciting. Because you actually watch these things destroy each other.
Yeah.
Like, it's real blood sport. And what I've been wondering, because, like, you always think of, like, what were people like? Well, no, like, what were people like? Like, how did people just, like, what was in people's minds as they watched gladiators kill each other, right? Like if we were around in like 50 AD or whatever.
Is it that much different than like a boxing match or like an MMA fight?
Yeah, well, it's not to the death. Like people, it's there's sport killing in the gladiatorial games. But even now, like a lot of people like think they're above, morally above watching a boxing match because it's not. So what I've been wondering is like, so, if I was a Roman back then, I probably would have thought this is perfectly normal to watch these slaves kill each other for my fun.
Yeah.
And I started wondering like, what if robots are conscious?
What if they become sentient?
Well, no. What if they always have been conscious?
Okay.
And we just didn't understand that. And now I've been watching robots kill it, because I've been trying to think, like, what sins am I making against the future AI, right? So what if I've been watching BattleBots all week? What if these things are conscious and they're actually dying?
Oh, my Lord. That's a... What's it called? Blanking.
This is the kind of thing that would have sounded insane if a Roman said this, like in 2000 AD, 200 AD, that slaves are conscious and are equal to us and stuff like that. No, obviously not.
Sure.
Now we look at it as morally repulsive that they did that.
I mean, it's panpsychists will tell you that absolutely everything is conscious, including those stones.
Yeah.
So who knows? You know, who knows what's true? It's I'm blanking on the name of the philosopher, or it's basically the same argument. It's like you might as well believe in God because you don't want to risk
eternal.
Yeah, Pascal's wager. Yeah. There you go. Thanks. It's the same. It's Pascal's wager, but for AI and sentient robots.
That's I think about that a lot because I do. It's like I don't really believe there's going to be super intelligence. Like I don't expect it. But
why?
You know. I don't know, because I'm naturally somewhat conservative, and like it's hard for me to imagine something that is until it happens.
Don't you think that some of the LLMs like are intelligent already, in the sense of like as intelligent as an intern is intelligent?
Yeah, but I mean, like super intelligence in the sense that it just like obsoletes human intelligence, right? Where like if there's anything that a human can do better, this thing would just learn how to do it and overtake it. You know.
I think what they lack is motivation and spirit in some sense, as elusive these terms might sound, but that's what they don't have right now. So you still need the human spark, wherever that comes from, of kind of steering it.
I also think it could happen, right?
But I think it's distinct
from intelligence.
I want to
make sure I don't sin against these things. So they don't come back for me and my family.
Maybe don't watch too many BattleBot things and don't scream at the LLMs too hard. But you were saying you wanted to expand on the various LLMs use for your workflow.
Yeah, so I gave the examples, right? Like there's like a benefit for using models that are really quick. You know, like if I'm on Bash, if I'm on the command line and I want, like waiting a second is a long time, right? You want it to be faster than typing it out yourself or going to Google or Stack Overflow. Because you, like a lot of those types of things, you can get an answer within 10, 20, 30 seconds by Googling it or going to Stack Overflow or something. But that's a context switch. So the beauty is that you can avoid the context switch and you can do it a little faster on the command line. Then there's the coding agents where you're just going back and forth in dialogue. But the most valuable, but those are like incremental changes. Like, you know, do those make me twice as effective as a programmer? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Mm. You know, it's not like a total game changer. The one that's more of a game changer was Tony's thing where he does it in... You know, he adds a third player to the team, like a code architect.
Yeah.
So that's O1 Pro, the one that costs $200 a month. The one that's autistic with a speech impediment.
You don't maybe turn around.
Yeah,
here.
you speak quietly with him. You know, you don't no loud noises. You know. Yeah. So. What you want to do with O1 Pro there's a good article about this where it's like you want like a prompt in like three or four steps, right? What you're trying to do, like what your goal is, and each one of these is like a paragraph with like one or two sentences. Like what my goal is, right? I can give an example. Like I was working on a little Android project last night, and I was trying to cross compile it, or a little mobile project. I was trying to, it had some Rust code, and I wanted to cross-compile it to iOS, like so make it run on iOS. And there was one dependency that couldn't.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like that's my goal, right? And then the next thing is like, what I want your output to be, right? I want you to make a. You are my code architect. I want you to make a detailed diagnosis of the problem and step-by-step plan to fix it. Or if you don't have enough information, give me as many things that I can do to give you more context as possible.
Let's go on an adventure.
Yeah. So you know, that's the output, right? Like either, you know, give me a diagnose the problem and give me a solution, or help me tell me what other questions I should answer so that you could get a solution.
Do you use any predefined kind of software architecture style documents like Sandwich talked about?
I haven't tried that yet, right? So this Sandwich and the Sovereign Engineering Cohort had this idea of, I don't know if you've talked about it with him on the pod.
No, I linked to this stuff like one or two times, but I'm pretty sure no one looks at any written text or clicks any links anymore.
His idea is to even formalize it even more, to use like old school water flow software engineering practices that they used to build like airplane software and stuff. It's like very, very formal.
Yeah.
And I think that is good too, but it's a big investment, so I'm going to wait until...
I think he had great success with it, and I think the reason is because we build up this knowledge base of how to do this stuff over the last 50 years or whatever, yeah. and it's all accessible to the LLM,
yeah, so the they model. Understand it. So the models yeah. understand it, waterfall really well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they've probably read 500 books on it.
Exactly.
So so that's really interesting, but it's also like, one of the things I've noticed with this LLM stuff is that whatever you're trying to do, you should try to go like about 10% of the speed you were wanting to do it. Just go slow and be
slow
very,
and step
very
by step.
Deliberate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and especially me as like a programmer, yeah. I go fast.
Yeah.
I go fast. I learn just enough to do what I want to do, and I move on.
Yeah.
So it's against my nature kind of to do something really slow and deliberately. But when I do it, there's a much better payoff.
Do you use any like similar to like cursor rules or those kind of things to just tell it that all the time?
What I use is this. Paul Miller has this nice little VS Code extension called Prompt Buddy,
yeah.
and all it does is like, it's a markdown file, and then it has like context HTML tags. So like,
yeah.
you know, left chevron context, right chevron, you know, space, new line, and then like left chevron forward slash context. They're like yeah. HTML tags, and then inside the context you can put file paths
yeah.
to local files. And so, like, I just have, like, a few of these open at all times, and I edit them. So, like, the first paragraph is, like, what I'm trying to do. The second paragraph is, like, what I want your output to be. And then the rest is context. So, I'll say context, colon, and then write as many things that I think could be relevant. Because that's the other thing about O1 is you want to give it as much. This article that Tony sent me is, like, whatever you think is enough context for O1, give it 10 times more. So you just try to do as much as possible. Give it as much context as possible. And so I don't go back and forth with it. Like, oftentimes the first attempt won't get it good enough, and so instead of chatting with it and be like, hey, I have an idea, like, could you try it this way, I just go back to the prompt, I add more context, and do it all over again.
But that's not true for all models, right? Like,
no, talk
to
Pablo
about this, because it's like we went over, like, is adding more context always a good idea?
With this one, I haven't gotten to the point where I've had too. I just add more and more and more.
Interesting.
Like, it has to be relevant, though, right? But, like, oftentimes I'll go on these things where after the fifth or sixth prompt, when I finally have, like hundreds or thousands of lines of context, you know, I don't type it all, but a lot of it is... So these context tags we'll just copy in files, right? So
yeah.
when I was doing that cross-compilation thing, I had, you know, one line to the Nix file that defines what my environment is, another line that had my cargo dependencies, so it could see which one I'm trying to do, another line that had my build script, which had some environment variables and stuff, and then another line was just text error that I was getting. So like when I would run my build, I would just pipe it into a text file, and that was already included in my prompt. So if it didn't work, it would already be ready for yeah. the next round of prompting.
Yeah.
And so there's a little hotkey that you just boom, and you know, you copy that prompt, and this Prompt Buddy plugin just injects the files into the context. So you just are able to include the files you think are relevant, but not more. Like, it doesn't help to give it the whole code base.
Yeah, yeah.
95, yeah. 99% of the code base is not relevant oftentimes. So you give it specific files, and then I'll, you know, oftentimes it'll ask for some more things. So like, what does this say if you run this on the command line, right? And so I'll just start adding all of those things in, you know, above the context tags. And then eventually it will figure out what the problem is, you know, even if
yeah.
it's very difficult. Like, I've had some where, I had one where I was trying to, God, I forget what I was trying to do something with on an Android app. Like, I've been just doing all these little experiments with mobile apps, trying to make like a better way to make mobile apps. And it figured out that the problem was I was running a VPN, Mulvad, and I needed to set one environment variable to get it to work while Mulvad's running.
Really?
Unbelievable. Like, at one point he's just like, on one time
yeah.
he's like, are you running any sort of like firewall or something?
Yeah.
And I was like, he asked some stuff. He didn't say VPN specifically.
Yeah.
And then I said no, and we've screwed around for a couple more prompts. And eventually he asked again, and then he included VPN. And I was like, oh, yeah, I am running a VPN. How would that make a difference? I'm trying to run something on my emulator on my device. He's
yeah.
like, it's something weird about the network stack that changed with emulators. And it's like,
okay.
Like, how do you figure, like,
yeah.
that would have taken me.
Yeah.
I probably would have never figured that out.
Yeah.
And, you know, within half
yeah.
an hour of prompting, I was able to
yeah.
figure out just by iterating more and more. So this is the sort of thing like a coding agent won't figure out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he doesn't have enough context.
You might be able to figure it out. It's like one Stack Overflow answer buried
yeah.
in like
yeah.
a, you know, 10-year-old thread or
yeah.
something, and you want to, you know, massage,
like,
the feet of the guy.
O1 is able to build this like
yeah.
big conception of what
yeah.
your problem is.
That's insane.
And it's not just like they're able to kind of do these like one-off requests, yeah. like you know, like Claude is really good at, yeah. especially in yeah. coding.
So what's the so that
I asked it to give me an implementation plan, right? So and sometimes I'll say like you know I have a junior developer who's going to implement yeah. this, so make sure my junior yeah. developer's Claude. you know, make sure it's like don't make it numbered. Have numbered steps, right? Because yeah. I need stuff that now Claude can interpret.
Yes.
Because like sometimes the first couple times I tried this, and I've done this like 10, 20 times total.
Yeah.
But it's basically worked every time and saved me like this is where it's like, yeah, I just did this 5 times faster. Yeah. Or I accomplished something that I wouldn't have done otherwise.
Yes.
I would
yes.
have just had worse software. So a lot of this stuff is not, like, people talk about how much more productive it is. And it's like, for me, it's like, it's not necessarily like, I mean, it's a phase change. It's like I'm yes. doing things that I wouldn't have attempted previously.
You're able to tackle something that you would have never tackled otherwise.
No, I wouldn't have tackled otherwise, right? Yeah. Like, it's not like
because the learning curve of like getting to know the thing you want to use and all those kind of things is way too hard. It takes yeah. like 2 years to get up yeah. to speed to actually build the first prototype.
A lot of the things I want to do, I have like an idea that's extremely technical, but I don't actually want to learn all the intricacies of yes. that technical domain.
Yes.
Because I'm not a weaponized autist, right? Like, I'm not. I can't.
Contrary to popular
belief. No, I don't. I'm not. I get bored. Like, it's not interesting to me. All the syntax, all the horseshit, I don't care. Yeah. But I like the idea.
Yeah.
So I want to achieve the idea. That's why I tend to be like a better manager than I am like an individual contributor.
Yeah.
Because I'm good at the idea level but, and working with people, but I don't like to actually do the actual work a lot of times.
Yeah.
I have a limited...
It's also you know, like fixing syntax errors is just kind
of but that's why
wrecking anyone's
the LLMs are so fun is because it basically lets me to play purely on that level. And I don't have to do, it's like we were talking earlier, it's like there's a difference between coding and like programming or coding and like software development, right? Like what I'm doing, what we're doing with these LLMs is software development, it's programming, but it's maybe not coding, right? Like it's maybe not figuring out, like I don't have to figure out where the semicolon goes. Like I made a Nix build description or build like thing to be able to bundle Xcode, right?
Yeah.
So you can install Xcode just for a specific project exactly how you want it, and it's not global, so you don't use global stuff for your project. And like I'd never really written a Nix derivation before. I'd seen them, but whenever I needed one, I would ask DPC at Fetty, like, hey, could you do this for me? Because he's really smart at this, and I'm not.
Yeah.
But with this, I was able to, like, in half an hour, get, or maybe an hour, mostly because you're waiting for these long, you know, Xcode's like 5 gigabytes or something, so you have to, you know, open it and copy it around and stuff to download it.
I think that's what's so cool and powerful about it. It actually allows you to try things, like you said, you know, try things that you otherwise would have never tried.
Yeah.
And you just need a kind of a rudimentary understanding of various building blocks, and then you can try to throw them together in a novel way and just see what comes out, and then you know immediately if you want to pursue that idea or not, because you already
you can see like there's some
working.
Programmers who are like, you know, this doesn't help me at all,
yeah,
and like one thing that often tells you is like, well, they're operating mostly on the like syntactic coding level
potentially,
right?
Yes,
they're not you know, they haven't transitioned to trying to like work in ideas and then have that thing do the translation to the machine code that is React.js. That's another way I'm thinking about it. It's like, you know, we started from like these punch cards with like literal like logic gates on them, and then like assembly was high level, and then C was high level, right? Like Linus Torvalds talks about C. He's like, this is a high level language to me.
Yeah.
Like assembly's low level, you know, and then it came to Java and Python gets higher and higher and higher. And now our object code is React.js, TypeScript.
Yeah.
Right? Which is transpiled to right.
you know, just by code that's prompted into existence.
Yeah. It's like that's becoming low level code now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
no,
funny.
It's insane. It's insane. I figured out that in the beginning, like my goal, I'll tell you what my goal is for the Vibe line. So I already talked about the kind of the pipeline for MP3 files on my phone that actually automatically get published to Noster, and everything that's on Noster will automatically transform itself into a podcast feed. That's the goal, including transcripts, including like SAP and value splits and all this kind of jazz. So I think I'll have that in, I don't know, if I keep at it, maybe in a month from now or so, everything kind of working well enough for me. What I want to have for the Vibe coding part, the Vibe line, is again, like I want to step out of the shower, speak into the phone, an idea that I have, Yeah. And the next time I sit down on my
Jordan
actual
Peterson
computer,
like this.
Yes, that's why he enters
app into existence.
Yes, yes, the logos.
The logos.
Yes,
yeah.
The logos.
I speak my.
But that's app also into that's also why I think it's so fascinating, because it's like the logos is the root word of dialogue as well. That's why Verveke calls it dialogos all the time. And we are entering into a conversation, kind of with ourselves, with technology, with LLMs, with all the things. Mm-hmm. If you do it on a Nostr context. It's even kind of a communal dialogue, you know, it's a communal conversation where you blast it out and you see what the swarm around you, kind of what your web of trust thinks about an idea or about a thing and so on. But anyway, like the speaking about trying something, like I would have never tried that without vibe coding LLM assistance. Yeah. Never, ever. Yeah, like building that out wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And now I can actually do it myself. Mm-hmm. Like it's, again, like investing like 1 hour a day or so just to push that along a little bit. And I actually managed to one-shot a Nostr Profile Explorer yesterday night, one-shot it. Yeah. It was a shower thought.
Yeah.
I recorded it. The whole pipeline kicked into gear, it extracted the prompt, I copy-pasted it into Cursor, and it worked.
One interesting thing about this, like how you describe how you're using it, is like how much more productive would you be if you did it 8 hours a day? Maybe not much.
I don't even care about productivity, because that's the whole reason to do the sovereign engineering thing, for example, was to do exploration and ideation. Yeah. That was kind of the two words we landed on when we thought this up. We want to kind of accelerate what people, kind of the ideas people have, and just try shit out.
Yeah.
Just try as much stuff out as we can, and kind of also in dialogue figure out what makes sense and what doesn't. And if something makes sense, pursue it more, and so on. And I feel like that supercharges it so hard.
Yeah.
I can literally vibe my shower thoughts into existence now in like 3 hours or something.
Yeah.
You know? It's like in no time at all, because most of the stuff happens in the background. I don't have to look at Claude if it vibes in YOLO mode.
Yeah.
I don't have to. It's just like, I'll give
you
it.
You only have that inspiration a little bit every day. So you can't do that all day. But it actually makes it more human, because everyone's scared that the LLMs are going to like take everyone's jobs. I'm like, no, this is actually making me more human. I get to do the things that humans are good at, which is the inspiration.
Yeah. And it's also like, usually you don't try these things out because it's not worth pursuing, because it takes so much effort.
Yeah.
So the shower thought goes away again.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't even bother writing it down or like, because
to do like really good web development, like I am capable of this, but I have to almost become a different person for like a week, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and I can do it, but it's like,
yeah,
it's, you have to almost change who you are to achieve it.
No, absolutely.
It interferes with the rest of my life.
And you talked about how you were already kind of better fitted for a manager position and just like pure coding and all those kind of things. And you did all of this that you're doing right now already, but you used humans instead of LLMs. It's similar for me that I realized that it's not very useful for me to stick with coding.
Yeah.
I have way more leverage and way more impact and can move the needle way more if I basically, I don't program computers, but I program the minds of people. That's why I started writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I
that's
realized.
That's why you bought these microphones.
Yes. Absolutely. That's the point.
The audience is being programmed to the 4 or 5 people who are listening right now.
I think most coders, myself included, if you're working on something, you're too close to the metal. You don't even see the forest for the trees.
Oh, yeah.
And that's
what I mean by become a different person. It's like,
yes.
And if you don't do that, your software sucks.
Yeah.
You have bugs. Like, it doesn't work.
You have to be close to the metal.
You have to be close to
the metal. But that's also, I think that's why we need both.
Yeah.
And I think also what a good dialogue does, it brings you out of a certain mode of thinking because it adds another brain to the mix that sees things differently.
Yeah.
And you step out and you get the overview again and you see the forest again, and then you can go back down and actually hammer away at the thing again.
But
and so
this reminds me of another idea we were mentioning earlier. It's like we were talking earlier and I had an idea. I was telling you about how I wanted to introduce more of these MCPs into my thing.
So yeah.
MCP is just something, it's like a standardized way of telling a model about a tool, right? Like one tool could be read a file.
Yeah.
Another tool could be read a tweet. Another tool could be post to Nostr, right? Like its ability to do something. Because all these models can do is predict the next word, right? Like that's all they know how to do, large language models. And they don't have any ability to do tools.
I sometimes wonder, what is it that we are doing? Can we do more?
Yeah, no, that is actually, I mean, that is how you think. I mean, it is. There's also like an interesting Claude post like yesterday about how, trying to understand how Claude thinks. And they were like, they presented some evidence that it actually can plan a rhyme. Like, it is planning to rhyme in a poem.
Yeah.
And you can see that it's preparing for this. So it's not just thinking one word ahead. It is thinking one word ahead, but it's also planning a rhyme.
Yeah.
And you can see it lining up. Yeah. You know, so it is interesting. Yes, it is just...
the issue, right? We don't know how thinking works.
It is predicting the next word, but it's doing more than that.
We don't know how we do it.
Right? Like, it's not just, like...
We don't know how we do it, right? That's the issue. So we also, like, now we build thinking machines, basically, as far as I'm concerned, and we don't know how they do it.
I mean, right now it seems like we're learning most about how we do it by watching how the machine can do it, right?
Absolutely. But it's also, and I think that's why dialogue is so important.
Yeah.
And I deeply, deeply care about this because you don't know where a good conversation takes you. You have no idea.
No idea.
And it's very different than thinking. But it's also, it is part of thinking. Like sometimes when you're thinking hard, you're in a dialogue with yourself, basically.
Yeah.
And writing plays a large part as well, because if you're writing, you're in a different mode than when you're talking. Like, that's very apparent.
Oftentimes, like learning to think, a lot of it is like, how do you take, like, I've learned to be pretty good at this. How do you go and like generate kind of a novel idea? And then how do you also destroy that idea, right? You have to, you kind of have to, you know, play both sides of it, right?
You want to be your own devil's advocate.
Yeah, basically. you have to love your idea enough to come up with it.
And you have to love your idea to also enough to be willing and able to attack
turn
it.
Turn on it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, out of love.
Yeah.
That's the right stance.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, like if you love your kid, you will tell it. Yeah. You will sometimes be angry.
Exactly. No, but let me go back to the model context protocol thing. So, like, this is a way to give more context to a model and, like, basically allow it to do stuff, to feed it more information, to see if it's, you know, so it can think better or allow its thinking to actually have some sort of side effect, like writing a file. And so, like, one thing was on vibe coding, one of the things that I noticed is that oftentimes the model, especially when you're working on, like, a UI, the model has to know when it's done, right?
Yeah.
Like, especially a coding model, right? But it can't actually see the screen, you know? So it's just totally guessing. And I mean, it's amazing when it works, but then sometimes you'll see, you know, you see the screen and it's obviously wrong. Like, the button's flowing off the side of the screen and this thing doesn't know, right? So, you know...
You can feed it a screenshot.
One of the ideas is there's, like, model context protocols thing that just came out, like, a month or two ago where you can feed it, you know... allow it to call a function, get screenshot, right, and see what the screen looks like, you know, and you can give it like a prompt template where, like, hey, well, as we're doing this, when you think you're about done, call this MCP function and compare it with the screenshot I gave as context and see if it's pixel perfect. If not, fix it.
Yeah.
Right? So I haven't really done this yet. That's one of the next things I'm planning on doing.
Cursor can do that already. I feed screenshots into Cursor all the time.
Yeah, but
it will be able to understand it and actually fix stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't do it continually, and it's not its own standalone tool, which is what you are trying to do.
Well, it's like, so a lot of this stuff is like, you see, how can you improve the thing, and how do you make it so it's automated so you don't have to, you know... Like, it used to piss me off where to put the semicolon. Now it pisses me off that I have to take the screenshot, you know? So that's one idea. You know, another idea is there's this thing called language server protocols that it's like sort of a standard way to make like IDE functionality into just a basic text editor. So, for example, if you're looking at code, there's a thing that allows you to jump to the definition. You see a function that's being used. I want to be able to jump to the definition so I can see it. Or I'm trying to use a function, and I don't have the right name. Like, can you suggest me what the real name is, right? And so they can do all these things that will basically prompt a human programmer or suggest to a human programmer that their code is right or wrong, right? Like, when you're looking at code in an editor, you look to see if there's any red anywhere that is your LSP yelling at you, like, hey, you spelled that function wrong, or hey, you have a syntax error. And so there's a couple LSPs now that can, or there's model context protocols for these LSPs. So you can tell it basically, hey, you can look here to see if you have any syntax errors.
Yeah.
So I don't have to tell you anymore, because it's still, a lot of these still will spit out bad syntax, because they, in a sense, don't really know, oftentimes they don't know if they're right or not.
They don't have a super tight feedback loop, but you can tell immediately if you give them access to a feedback loop, whether it's tests or just like observing a terminal or something.
Yeah.
Then stuff works way better.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's why people, if you hear people talking about, what's it called, Cursor, that's what Cursor has done. I mean, they did like two things. They integrated into the text editor everyone knows, VS Code, so you don't have to learn a new thing.
Yeah.
And then they integrated very, very deeply with all of the feedback that's available in this text editor that humans use, right? Yeah. Like the LSP running, or maybe ability to run a browser inside the IDE.
See the linter error.
It feeds all this feedback, and that's one of the reasons why it's better than command line tools. But fundamentally, you could do all these same things with command line tools, and then it wouldn't be a proprietary tool. And in a sense, that would be kind of better to have it more out in the open.
You know what I want to have once all the tooling is done? What I want to have is basically like a vibe coding as a service, where you speak into a device. You're in the bathtub, smoking a cigar.
Like Winston Churchill, that's what you're talking about.
Exactly.
It's like vibe coding means you're like Winston Churchill dictating his speeches in the nude in a bathtub, smoking a cigar.
But what you need, you just have a screen. Let's say your bathroom mirror is actually like an LCD mirror, you know? And you just vibe code a thing into existing just by speaking into the mic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you will live see the simulator on the screen, how it looks, how it feels, what it does.
Yeah.
And you just keep talking to it until it is how you want
it to be. I'll have my phone and a little plastic bag in the bathtub with me, and I'll see my app emerge.
Yeah. Just get it waterproof, you know, like wireless mic.
Yeah, exactly.
Clip it to your beard.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go. I think we're reasonably close to that, because that's basically how I've been using the things up to now.
Yeah.
And I just still need manual steps and so on, and I need to deploy it myself. And But it's basically like, build it like it's just like an XGS app deployed on Versal and so on. And it's like, and in the browser, there's nothing stopping us from building that.
No.
And that would be a super useful service that you can also actually sell, like free business idea. It's like, you know, it create a hotline for all the moms that want to have websites.
Yeah.
And it's just like, automatically, they can, while they are still on the phone, see how the website looks like. And it's like, oh no, make that button a little bigger. And like, this should do something else.
One of the interesting things from like the Bitcoin open source point of view about all this stuff is how indefensible most of these products are, right? Like Cursor is, you know, everything it can do, this is going to be open source, right?
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of these things, like any of these like coded like agents, right? It's like almost, it's like you know, it's like the only way to have any defensibility is to have a user that will never be able to do like you know, compose these things together. So like, I don't know.
We saw this already with the image generation stuff.
Yeah.
The image generation stuff, like all the stable diffusion and all these kind of things. The open models caught up relatively quickly.
Although that just changed like 2 days ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure. It's. I think the proprietary stuff will always
be. The open stuff will be able to do studio. I mean, I think eventually it will. I mean, the S curve eventually will flatten out, and eventually, I think the open stuff will be just as good.
Yeah.
Like unless there's some like massive training run, and then there's like the whole industry goes bankrupt, like in the early 2000s or something, and you can no longer do $100 billion training run. Like I could imagine that. Like you could have the state. Like, but as long as you can continue training these things, the open source will always catch up, I think.
I think so too, just because of the nature of data, basically, the nature of information. I mean,
but more so for agents than models, even. Like, any of these, like, agentic things that are actually more valuable because they allow you to accomplish a goal, right? Like, anytime any sort of product is, like, you want a product, like, a product is for accomplishing a human end, you know? And oftentimes the models are, like, a part of that, but it's, like, the agent experience itself. Like, everyone's at SEC is much more passionate about Claude than they are about Cursor than they are about a specific model, right?
Yes,
because Cursor allows them to accomplish their aim.
It's the same, like
I think there's less defensibility on the agents because it's much. You don't need to do a massive training run to like get a world class one.
That's what I also mentioned about the pipelines I'm currently building out. It's all small steps. I don't care what models are used.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I really don't care.
Yeah.
It's all about the tooling, and I think what ChatGPT got right is it built the right interface.
Yeah.
It really built the right interface. It's also what Google got right, I think, actually. And now I think what Cursor got right.
I mean, that's a good point on Google though, because like the early search engines
were terrible.
They look like Chinese websites, like where it's just a million logos.
It looked like a phone book.
Yeah, it looked like a phone book. Yeah. Yeah. And Google's insight was like, let's just only have a text input.
Yeah, one, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I think ChatGPT got the interface right. It's very
funny,
human,
Google's
interface, right?
Google's insight was no ads. That was basically their insight.
Yeah.
Like no ads on the homepage.
Company built on ads.
Yeah, built on ads, right? Yeah. Like the way they built the biggest ad business was by rejecting ads in the
hiding
beginning.
The ads at first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not smacking them into the face of the users.
Yeah.
In terms of walking, let's try to it's gonna be noisy for a little bit. So we're gonna try to cross the street and go up to the park. And in the park, it should be really nice. Like we can.
I had a coffee up there.
Yeah, let's go there. Let's walk through the park and that should be. I think it's the most sensible path.
Yeah.
But the thing about the I think the reason why people at the core currently are so enthused by Cursor is because it's obviously
against their will too. Most of these people hate proprietary software and they're
absolutely.
It's funny. Absolutely. Like one by one they fall to the proprietary software that is Cursor.
But it just shows you where things are going and how powerful this stuff really is.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, it works really well. Just like ChatGPT works really well. Google worked really well. It's just a better tool. And the thing about it has to be integrated. The feedback loops, they have to be tight. The thing you mentioned about the screenshots, it has to be. Otherwise, that's where the shift comes from.
It removes cognitive overload.
Yeah.
Right? Or cognitive like load. Right. Like if everything's integrated, then you don't have to think. You're not context switching and trying like the amount. Your context is you economize context by having like the human context that you have to fit in your head as you work.
Because what you want to actually remain in, that's also what a good dialogue brings you. It's like you remain in a flow state.
Yeah.
So if we are talking, we are having a great dialogue. You remain in a collective flow state.
Yeah.
Unless you're getting run over by a car.
Yeah.
But that's what you want to have, and that's what you also want to have coding. But on the coding side, it's like a syntax error will fuck up your flow state basically in some sense.
Yeah.
And what I'm finding now with all the basically talking to LLMs in some sense, or trying to think through things with LLM assistants or LLMs as conversational partners, is like I can, just because the feedback loops and everything is so instant, I can remain in the thinking flow state of what I actually want to try to achieve. And it has to be. But it can only work if everything is super tightly integrated. Yeah. It's almost like, okay, I have a strange comparison, but I think it works. Why people on Twitter, you're in Twitter, it doesn't matter if it's Twitter or TikTok or whatever, you do not want to leave the app.
Yeah.
That's why everything is loaded in line.
Yeah.
If it's a link to a YouTube video, people will not click it.
Yeah.
If it's a link to an article, people will not click it.
Yeah.
If the video is rendered in the feed, different story.
Yeah.
People will watch it and all those kind of things. So we know that this is the case. We absolutely know that this is the case. And I think it is because people don't want a context switch.
Yeah.
Or let me put it differently. It's not a conscious thing. It's like context switching is so expensive and it completely gets you out of the flow.
Yeah.
And so if you have a highly integrated tool like Cursor is, you remain in the flow state and you're never forced to context switch out of it.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the secret sauce of why it works so well.
Yeah.
It's just like you can stay in that place and you can continue the conversation that you have with your IDE basically.
Yeah.
And it's just gonna, you get to the next thing and to the next thing and to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's almost like infinity scrolling, but it's infinity scrolling new code.
Yeah. And one interesting thing is that I do a lot of this, but for like a few very technical problems that I'm interested in right now. So all of these like, sometimes multi-hour conversations that span like 20 chats, right, where you reset the context or try to pull over what you had previously, or, you know, I try it with Grok. I'm paying for every single one of these frontier models right now. Like, I'm trying to find ways to pay more. Like, I went from, like,
give me better
being
models.
Frustrated that I was paying $20 a month with ChatGPT, where it's like, God, I'm only paying like $300 a month right now.
Where can I
spend more? Like, you know? But the thing is, like, I don't trust these, like, you know, the questions I'm really interested in life are not like technical problems necessarily, right? Like a software
problem. So you're hesitant with some
questions. I don't ask them any philosophical stuff. Like the type of stuff I'd write to Dear Diary.
I mean, you'll be thrown into the gulags in
no
time.
I don't write any of that stuff. Like I basically approach these things as if it's all going to be in a court deposition someday. Like I won't put anything in one of these that wouldn't be okay in a deposition, right? Literally. But that does really limit how useful they are.
Yeah.
Because like while these technical problems are interesting, if I could solve the bigger, more philosophical human problems in my life, that's a million times more useful than solving this whole technical thing. So that's what one of the things that I still don't have an answer for. Because like I've been playing a little with like stuff like Ollama, but they're stupid.
In comparison. I still think they're good enough for most things. But do you think that we'll be able to fix that with local models?
Well, I'm looking at those GPUs on eBay. I think GPUs solve most of our problems.
So, a couple hundred bucks for subscriptions or like or investing
half
20K.
A Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the only thing in life right now where I'm like, there's a button that says 50K, and I'm like, I want to hit the button. Like, with anything else, I'm like, no, I can see a little tread left on my tires. So let's not change them for a while, right?
If you would buy your own GPU farm, like what would you train it on?
First thing, number one, I would train a model to understand Zig. Number one.
Step one.
Number one, yeah. Before we get to the big problems in one.
You know, like the step one, solve AI.
Step two,
solve the world's problems. For you, it's like step one, teach
Zig.
AI how to use Zig.
Zig, yeah. It really ruined my cohort experience. I wanted to go make an entire stack of beautiful Zig tools for Nostr. I wanted the fastest entropy.
Yeah.
And just Zig, pure Zig, you know? No, just everything's the fastest.
What do the Zig enthusiasts say about LLM stuff? They must be aware that.
Well, so the funny thing is they don't really care. So that my point earlier about how like you can listen to someone how they talk about LLMs and then you figure out kind of at what level they deal like work at software kind of. A lot of these Zig people are like the super low level like trying to they're trying to make the program good.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily like trying to do a big idea.
Yeah.
And so they don't care. Because they're like wizards.
Yeah.
They're the autist I'm not, right? Like they know exactly where the semicolon goes. They know exactly how the concurrency works, you know? They enjoy writing the semaphore to make the concurrency work. I hate that part.
Yeah.
You know? So like in general, the Zig people, like the really hardcore software engineers, in my experience, don't really care about this stuff very much because it doesn't help them very much.
Yeah.
Because the LLMs are good at what they're already good at. You know, so yeah, that's kind of a little bit difficult.
So first thing you would do is bridge that gap.
I mean, Zig is also interesting. Like, they basically don't have documentation. Like, their whole experience so far, which I think is actually kind of smart, you know, they're trying to make this really good low-level language, so they're trying to, like, prevent, like, entryism or whatever it's called, right? Like, a bunch of noobs from showing up and learning it. So they're like, hey, the standard library is the documentation. If you can't read the standard library, get the fuck out.
It's not RTFM, it's RTFC. Read the fucking code.
Which is smart, I think. Like, if you want to make like a really hardcore low-level language and you only want people like that around, it's a pretty good trade-off.
Yeah.
Right? Like one big Zig project is this Ghosty Terminal Emulator. I think it's going to be like, it's going to be a really interesting like, you know, you write code in terminals. Like I think it's going to kind of be a little bit more of a next generation of that. Like it's going to make a lot of interesting things possible. And the guy did something really interesting where he announced this thing like a year and a half ago, and he just made a closed beta where only he'd invite friends or like people who are proven Zig contributors because they're in Zig. And I was trying to get in there for a year, and he wouldn't let me in. But I think it made sense because he was able to have this tight community that gave really good feedback, and he never had to deal with idiots on GitHub issues posting bad bug reports.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent that's kind of valuable.
So that's the
first thing would be Zig. Yeah. I mean, the second thing I want to do is, what's it called? There are some of these things where you don't like train a frontier model. I don't want to trade a frontier model, obviously. Like that's billions of dollars, right?
Yeah.
I forget the name of it. There's some acronym where you can train like sort of a layer on top of an existing model. So you can take OLLaMA and like train a thin layer on top of it. And you can actually do this on like consumer computers.
Okay.
Like there are lots of examples of people who like, actually I might try this with Zig. I think it might actually work with Zig on my laptop or just renting a GPU, right? Like they show, like I've seen stuff about how people did this and they were able for like a $6 training run. Actually, I was going back to ChatGPT on this and it was like, I think I could, we had one conversation where he's like, I think we could fix your Zig problems with a $6 training run. Like he really hesitated to give me a number, but I just kept asking over and over, how much would it cost? And then finally, $6. I was like, really? I was expecting like 5,000. Like I'm a total noob at this thing, but so like stuff like that would be really fun. I think it would be really fun to try like these alignment layers, you know? Like there's a guy in Nostr named Someone who he did like one little project where he's trying to make an alignment layer, like one of these layers on top of it that basically censors it, but do it on Nostr data, right? So just make this thing talk like, take the intelligence that was done in the, like, frontier training run that costs a bunch of money, but then, like, sort of form it in a way that makes it sound like an Ostra user.
I see.
Like, something like that would be kind of cool, right? I don't know. I think these, like, little mini training runs on for, like, specific use cases, I think would be really interesting. I mean, the obvious one is I would just have it set up in my house, and then I would have, like, the biggest DeepSeek model running, and I would just spill my guts to it,
yes.
and all my problems yeah. in life, and all yeah. my yeah. difficulties, and it would basically yeah. be like my therapist.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of trying to build out right now. So I told you I kind of regret that I stopped, you know, like, appearing on podcasts and
yeah.
writing stuff and so on.
This is the first podcast I've done in like 3 years.
Yeah, the same for me, pretty much. And again, like, we don't treat it as a podcast. It's a dialogue. It's a conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's a walk.
Yeah, it's a walk, exactly. I want to take developers on a walk and kind of, you know, pick the brains. That's the point. But the thing why I kind of regret it. I mean, I had to do it. I was like burning out so hard. But I kind of regret it because now I have a gap in my recordings in some sense. And
yeah.
what I do in these conversations, also on the podcasts I appeared in the past and so on, also in writing, also in tweeting, you know,
yeah.
and now in like, I mean, I'm still tweeting on Nostra, like, you know,
yeah.
bite me.
Yeah.
But it's basically just it's almost like a diary.
Yeah.
It's, okay, I'm not sharing highly sensitive
yeah.
and private stuff and so on. Like, I mean,
it's
shared
it's a diary in the sense of like letters were in like the Western
yeah,
intellectual
exactly,
tradition,
exactly.
right? You publish your letters.
Exactly, exactly.
And it's somewhat private, but it's also like
yeah.
a record of your
It's just what's novel now is like that we up to now we only had the written word kind of
yeah.
accessible to people
yeah.
with letters and those kind of things. And now I really
or like
think
physical artifacts. I mean,
yes.
honestly, that's the thing we really have. For most of
yes.
human history, all
yeah,
we
yeah.
have is what pots did they make? You know?
Oh, absolutely.
What coins
absolutely.
Did they have? What pots did
yeah,
they make? What did their swords look like?
Yeah. What houses? Like what?
Well,
what stuff
how
out of stones did they build?
Right?
You know,
exactly.
like with obelisks and pyramids
yeah.
and those kind of things. That's the stuff that remains.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually something that I kind of worry about a little bit of our like current hyper digitalized civilization. Is like if things go south, nothing will remain.
Yeah, yeah.
we don't do clay tablets anymore.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
we should, you know, from
yeah.
time to time. But anyway, like the reason why I regret having this gap now is because I actually now I know that I can even build this myself and this tooling with local models and local things, like privacy conscious basically. And I just want to, like you say, almost like a therapist, but it's not really a therapist. It's like a therapist / diary / to-do list.
It's like a daemon,
slash...
a daemon, right? Like
yeah.
in
a daemon in the Unix sense.
Well, no, a daemon in like the Greek, like the daemon was like the spirit you would kind of talk to that like
yeah,
guided you through
exactly.
your life, almost like a guardian angel.
Exactly.
Like that.
And that's why
the
I come back
to talk about their daemon.
And that's why I come back to robot
debugging.
It's like
their muse.
Yes. And that's why I come back to robot debugging, because we know it really works. Because a dialogue, a conversation gets you out of the self-centered monological thinking loop that you're in, and then you can think yourself in circles really easily.
Yeah,
but you will get me out of my circle.
Yeah, yeah.
But an LLM, or even just sitting down and writing a diary entry, or talking to yourself,
yeah.
will also get you out.
Yeah,
and
this
so,
is one thing I would train on too. Is like making LLMs more disagreeable. Like that's one thing that's really annoying about them. Is
oh
they,
yeah, they're yes
they
man.
Agree with you all
yeah,
the
yeah.
time.
They're both
like,
sure they're yes man.
Yeah, yeah, I would much rather have yeah. one that is like. That is very conscious of the limits of their knowledge and very disagreeable. Like,
yeah, also,
am I wrong?
Also, like maybe it will say like that's a stupid idea.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah, exactly. I've never had an LLM tell me that.
No, that's but people tell me all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
A large discrepancy of
yeah.
that. But the way I see it, like what I want to build up now again, and I still have, you know, like I have my Twitter archive.
Yeah.
I have, I don't know, like 200 recorded conversations, those kind of things.
Yeah.
And so I wanna put this all in a pile. And have various agents kind of go over it,
yeah.
locally running. Like it's like just having a transcript of this stuff, having it full text searchable,
mm-hmm.
having it summarized, having it kind of tagged,
yeah.
and like with timestamps and so on. That's already so useful because
yeah.
then I can go back and can go like January 2023. What
yeah.
did I think about Nostra
yeah.
versus
yeah.
I don't know like December 25.
Yeah. It's really hard to remember stuff like that.
It is. That's why writing stuff down is so insanely useful because
yeah.
you always. Evolve and you also forget the insights that you had in the past and all those kind of things. So that's kind of what I'm aiming at right now. But yeah, we'll see. Maybe we'll need Zig for some of the tooling. So
yeah, you won't.
Should I buy you a GPU?
Yeah.
I can contribute with like
I would love a GPU.
One or two graphics cards, like it's not an issue.
I mean, what I should do is just get like a cheap video gaming one and just learn. Like, what even is a GPU? Like, I've never done
What even is a GPU?
Yeah, like, what even, how do you talk to it,
are
right?
Are these
like,
philosophical questions?
Yeah, here, no, but like, how do you feed fucking vectors and matrices into this and have it do something useful? I don't know, I have a math degree, I don't know. I know linear algebra, I have no idea what a GPU is.
You never did like an n-body simulation on a GPU before?
No. Well. I've never done GPU programming, to my knowledge. I'm not an autist. I keep trying to tell you this. I'm not.
I keep disbelieving.
I've been cosplaying all these years. I'm a pretender.
So you stepped up now. You're the idea guy now.
Yeah, I'm manager that, dude, slash this idea This is guy. The thing. Is like, dude, the age of the idea guys has begun.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. Man.
Yeah. Yeah, I really hope that I can have my vibe line kind of in shape and ready for the public, basically, rather sooner than later, because I really think that there's a lot of people that have really good ideas and no way of executing on them in any way, shape, or form. And,
yeah, I mean,
to be fair, execution is the hard part. Yeah. Like, ideas are a dime a dozen. Like, that everyone knows that. But I think it's still super valuable to
again, and that's the whole point, though, is like the LLMs are oftentimes kind of good at execution, especially you have a team of them.
Yeah.
And
execution is really cheap.
What works for one person works for another. There's a funny one, cheap. Like, I saw somebody had a really funny quote where they were like, you know, there's like some kind of lefty person that, you know, doesn't like global warming. And they were like, you know, every time I use an LLM to do some data processing, I really think about how it costs 10 or 1,000 times more to do this with an LLM than to do like some standard programming tool. Right.
Yeah.
And then I also think about
energy consumption.
Yeah, yeah. But then I also think about how it's 1,000 times cheaper than if a human did it.
Yeah.
So it's like, cheap. You know, it's like it's
depending
expensive.
On your metric. Monetarily cheap because it scales so well.
Yeah.
Energy expensive. Yeah. I mean, LLMs are way more energy expensive than our brain.
So I started to try to move away from Cursor, right, where everything's integrated into one thing, and to do it, you know, kind of put pieces together myself a little more. The actual thing I used to chat with Claude is Claude Code, their command line thing. And the interesting thing about it is that they don't, you know, with Cursor, everything is part of a subscription, like $20 a month.
Yeah.
And they probably heavily subsidize it because it's like, if you use Claude Code, even if you have a Claude membership, they charge per token. Mm. And so like you'll go back and forth, and oftentimes my little sessions for one feature will cost like $1. And it is reframing my thought on microtransactions to some a little bit.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean,
because usually I've always believed this idea of, you know, the microtransactions might not like the mental cost idea from Szabo, right? Like maybe that'll prevent it.
I think Szabo is right, but if you integrate it with Nostr, you don't have to think about it in that sense. You know what I mean?
No,
like
I don't.
The mental cost is like the weekly. You look back on the week and it's like, okay, this much I spent. You don't have to think about every single microtransaction.
Yeah.
But it's still a microtransaction and not a credit line, and that makes all the difference. And that's why it's appearing now. We have the pay per queue thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And like with the MCP stuff you mentioned, like Jesus is working on the DBMCP things, like bridging all that to Nostr and using Nostr as the substrate for AI model context stuff and micropayments, which makes all the sense in the world.
So in this world, do you see for any, like how often do you see how much money you're spending? You just have a budget and you see what?
Sure, you can. We can already with Nostr Wallet Connect set up a budget for certain things.
The funny thing is that like this, these experiences with Claude Code are kind of interesting. It's because at the end of every session, you like control D it twice to exit, and it'll print out how much it cost.
Yeah.
And I actually enjoy seeing how much it costs every time. I'm like, wow, what a deal, man. Like,
what a deal?
I got a feature for 92 cents.
Like, I was expecting now it's like you get out of the casino or something, and then it's like, oh, my Lord, how much money did I spend?
This is one of the first times where I'm basically doing microtransactions, and I enjoy, like, I don't really mind. Maybe it's because I feel like I'm getting a good deal, but I mind a lot less seeing the price, you know?
I see, yeah.
Because usually, every time you see money going out, it's kind of stressful, you know?
Yeah. But again, it just shows you how much value
also,
you get
it's
out of
it. It's so honest compared to like what your experience is with like a credit card statement where you're like, you know, I don't know. I've probably got 5 subscriptions right now.
There's very few things that we don't...
have been effing me for 2 years now.
I think it's because of the payments. I talked with Kelly about this, you know. It's like how payments fuck the internet in a large degree.
Yeah.
It's not only the mental transaction cost. But it's interesting that there's very few things that we pay by the meter. It's basically, it's like gasoline for your car. and electricity.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah.
And the water bill, basically. Yeah. Like, that's kind of it. Everything else is kind of like a flat.
I mean, it's funny. Like, the most hard necessities of life. Yeah. You know? Food, kind of, pay by the meter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think compute is going to be a necessity like this as well. And I don't even differentiate.
Like, the only people that have a food subscription are the ones on welfare, basically, or students, you know? Yeah. Some sort of welfare.
Yeah. So I think compute is going to be a necessity as well. And I don't even differentiate between compute and storage. Because to me, there is no difference. Like, let's say I want a photo of a flower that I want to use somewhere. And I know I have it on my hard drive. There's, to me, is no difference whether I store this photo and I find it or I generate it on the fly.
Yeah.
You know, so for many things, kind of storage and compute are almost equivalent.
Yeah.
It's like lorem ipsum or whatever. Yeah. It's like, do I have to have it stored on my hard disk somewhere?
I mean, in a sense, an LLM is actually a storage technology, right? Like,
in a sense. I mean, what is thinking and memory?
Well, someone had a good point where it's like, you know...
Can you think without memory? No.
He's like, we've lost a lot of the history of the early internet, right? The websites just went away.
Yeah.
But in a sense, they're retained in the context of these large language models. Because they could, you know, they're trained on it, right? Like... The training runs from 2 years ago. The training runs from two years ago in code websites that are now gone forever.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they are a storage technology in a sense. Especially the really big ones.
I mean, intelligence, thinking, and storage are very much interrelated. You need memory to think. Like you need thinking is about the future, and to access the future, you need to access the past, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
It's Yeah, it's strange how it's all interconnected, but yeah, I think compute will be metered, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And you need to have a micropayment substrate to make it all work, because the credit overhead and the credit risk just kills you.
I mean,
kills all the micropayments.
The other thing that's really interesting about it is like, I found there's something kind of magical about actually seeing the, like, I'd never been interested in GPUs until I saw that number from Claude, actually. Like, that's what started getting me interested, like, okay, so that's what a token costs, right? Like, I never really thought, people always talk about tokens. And again, I said this, we're walking in a circle right now. And every time I reach this topic, the spot, I'm like, Gigi, I'm not an autist.
Every time we pass this tree,
we're walking in a circle. And I make the same point every time we get to the side.
We'll break out of the circle.
Yeah. But I never tried it because I'm like, whatever, fucking nerd. I don't care what a token is. But it was kind of interesting. Like, it's like, okay, 97 cents. It's like 20,000 tokens or whatever. Interesting. Okay. So I'm actually, so like the interesting thing is like, it got me to think in terms of like the human action, you know, like you need, like for stuff to get better, a human needs to, like, you know, economize between scarce resources. You know what I mean? And you have to see the price.
Yeah.
You have to see the cost. Like you have to actually pay.
Yeah,
and in a sense, it's a lot more. It's like, at least in my own personal experience, as soon as I started seeing the actual cost for the actual tokens I was consuming, for the actual matrix math I was doing on a GPU, I didn't start actually thinking like a human actor as much.
Yeah,
right. Because I start like, if it's all just like I got a fiat cuck cursor subscription and I'm just being spoon fed, right? Like, I didn't think that way. But as soon as I started seeing the tokens, I'm like, okay.
A subscription is like an abstraction, right?
Yeah, well, but it's, and it's like you don't act. Like you don't, you're not faced with like...
You cannot act on abstractions, that's the point.
Yeah.
It has to be real, the cost has to be real, the decision has to be real. That's why simulations don't work. That's why sacrifice and other things are a thing. Like, it has to be real, you have to make it real.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it will not change how you act and how you think about it, basically. Like, if there are no consequences to your action, it will not influence your behavior. If there are actual consequences, then it will change your behavior.
Yeah.
Going over like a slack line, you know, without a harness and without like any protection is very different than just doing the same thing and you're like, it's inconsequential if you fall.
That's why I want to try like renting GPUs and doing some training and stuff, because it's gonna like... It will show you the reality of what is actually happening.
Of the cost
like, what is the brass tacks going on here? Like, what is the? Because I think that, like, that's another thing. Like, what is kind of unique about a human? It's like, well, that's the kind of the fundamental insight of like Austrian economics people is like, it's this economizing process. Praxeological, whatever the fuck, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that act of actually choosing, of taking action.
Yeah.
Like, that's the real magic. And yeah, there's something interesting about microtransactions in this context, at least, that like sort of activate that you in a lot more than like just a subscription does.
Yeah, it's and it doesn't, again, it removes the abstraction, and it shows you both on the consumer side and on the service side kind of the reality of how people are using it and what is kind of most needed. It's like a more, you know, it's a more free market dynamic in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to need some tobacco to think more clearly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
we're gonna get some snus sometimes.
There we go.
Norwegian
there
one.
There we go, yeah. That stuff is dangerous.
When the conversation just gets out of hand and everyone's dizzy.
Yeah.
So should we try to break out of the loop and hit the other park across the street?
Yeah, that works.
Let's try it.
A few more rounds, I think I'll probably go insane here.
Walking in circles. Zoo.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. I mean, there's another thing you don't... I mean, yeah. In a dialogue, you don't want to be economizing, you know, like...
No,
you don't want to be. You don't want to be acting in some sense, right? You just a circle is actually kind of natural, but I don't know. There's.
But that's also something where you I think, I keep trying to.
Go ahead. It's like that thing. Did I get a good deal there? Right. Like that's the thing that was interesting about seeing the number I paid.
Which
per
the subscription
question.
Hides.
Yeah. Because then you're like, you become much more aware of the cost of what you're doing and like. You improve. You're like,
yes.
If I'm amortizing my effort across this $20, no matter how I spend it,
I
don't improve as a prompter as much.
Yeah.
But if I see every word, this is another Jordan Peterson thing.
It's like UBI. That's why UBI is a terrible.
Every
idea.
Word so, yeah. I put into this thing costs me.
Yeah.
So you sort of
words carefully.
You sort of speak. You write more deliberately and thoughtfully this way.
Yeah,
because everything has a cost.
Yeah, which absolutely everything does. And every time you try to pamper over the costs, like paper over the costs in some sense, like a subscription does, you kind of destroy some sort of signal, some costly signal.
I mean, it's funny that I say this too, because I'm just thinking the first time I did this after Tony mentioned it, I quit and it was like $4. I'm like, what the fuck? I just spent a fifth of a month on one thing, right?
And now you have a different point of view.
Yeah, in a sense that... I prefer it now, even though my first reaction was like, what a ripoff.
Yeah. interesting. It's funny, by the way, that, you know, like it's 2025 now and we still talk about tokens. It's just the tokens changed. Like 2017 and 18, we talked about shitcoin tokens.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's compute tokens, basically, I guess. All right, let's go up here.
Previously, I worked in like fintech.
Where are we? No, like let's walk out here. That's better.
And back in like 2015, 16, everyone's on tokens and that, but it was all in terms of like sort of opening up their APIs.
Oh,
I
see.
I don't remember if they used the word token or it was like something like that. Yeah. It was all about like how do you pass an authentication credential between payment processors and stock and stuff. So like the people that had the really valuable moats, like some payment processor that doesn't innovate at all, how do they open it up to like fintech people? So that was basically all about tokens as well.
Yeah.
Like fintech was all about tokens. How do you make a REST API that opens up some valuable system and unlocks entrepreneurship?
I think what we are kind of heading into now is that we're going to send eCash tokens to something and we'll get back
this is really
AI
funny,
tokens and we can use them up.
I started working on eCash like three, I've been thinking about this, especially after talking to Callie more. And it's like, I've been working on eCash for like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I've been working on a long time, and I don't think I've internalized at all how important it is. Really.
Again, you were too close to the metal. You were too close to the metal. You were trying to make the thing work. That's also how I am different from you in a large degree. It's like, I don't see myself as a coder or even like software architect guy. I'm, first and foremost, I'm a power user.
Yeah.
I try to use both Bitcoin and Noster and the LLM stuff like as hard as I can.
Yeah.
I don't see myself, you know, like building an eCash system from scratch and so on. I might vibe code
it. It's funny, I'm not a power user actually. And I try to be, but I struggle.
That's what I mean, you know?
Yeah, I've tried something before and I just can't have the discipline to like I see the idea and I want the lifestyle, but I can't actually pull it off.
But it's true in the Bitcoin world as well, where people, we have like core devs, and like insanely knowledgeable Bitcoin people
yeah.
that never really use Bitcoin and cross the border with 12 words in their head or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Or like, you know.
I'm pretty primitive with how I use wallets. Yeah. Aside from like cold storage, I'm kind of like a...
But it's
worse than most people.
It's a different kind of understanding. And again, coming back to Rebecca, he talks about that a lot. It's like participatory knowing.
Yeah.
Like if you actually have to flee a country and you put 12 words in your head and you cross the border basically naked and you pop out the other end
yeah.
and you have your wealth intact
yeah.
and you start a new life with yeah. 12 words in your head, that's a different kind of knowing of what Bitcoin is
yeah.
and what it can do than kind of knowing how exactly like, you know, the mempool policy
yeah.
works
yeah.
or whatever.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's plenty of people that never really use Bitcoin, but are very close to Bitcoin, but they, you know, if anything, use it as like a savings technology or what have you.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for the eCash and the LLM stuff and all yeah. those kind of things as well. It's like you have to actually use, you know, like eCash wrappers. Like you know.
I mean, in a sense, I could almost see, you're not going to like this, but I could almost see Nostr going down. It's like in the history books, it's like this was the germination pond for eCash, you know, because this was where some of the most interesting little experiments were, like, what sort of stupid thing can you do with these tokens
yeah
that turns out to be actually like profound, right?
It's gonna what gets us out of the Skynet future, many of the
like eCash,
I actually have to rest my leg for
usability,
a minute,
like steps forward. It feels like just some guy does something. Oh, I got a really stupid idea for what to do on
yeah,
and Nostr is the only place I can try it.
And it's also
that's the only way I can find another guy with an eCash wallet.
Lots of the coolest things we ever built came out of like, let's just fucking do it for fun.
Yeah.
Because we kind of can do it. And yeah. and that's what I love so much about the vibe coding stuff. And that's kind of, I think, also the point of sovereign yeah. engineering. Again, I wanted to come back to that because I'm still trying to figure out what the thing is. What are we actually doing here? And so I think it is to have a test bed and access to other minds that, mm-hmm. that are at a similar level where you are. I mean, like, let's be real. How many people are there in the world right now that you can talk in depth about eCash and Nostr and all this stuff that we discussed? There's, I don't know, like, let's...
Hundreds?
Yeah. It's not thousands. It's very hard to And try to talk with a regular software guy about this stuff.
Oh,
it will take you 2 years.
It's the worst conversation ever.
It's terrible.
I don't even bring this stuff up anymore.
You can't, because the knowledge gap is so wide that you can't even have a meaningful conversation. Yeah.
It makes me dislike Bitcoin and Nostr more. Or, you know, like, if I have to explain it to someone who doesn't get it, I'm like, oh god.
But that's also why I think Bitcoiners are so hated in some sense, because it's like it's just all gibberish to the regular person that isn't up to speed with that stuff. Just like, you know, Nostr and DVM stuff and eCash stuff, it's like, it's all gibberish to many people, I think.
Yeah.
But it's so cool to work with other people that see the potential in this mm-hmm. technology and try and just experiment with it.
Like, one thing that Nostr is really good at is, like, in like software systems, like some of them are really, really, really powerful, but it takes an incredible amount of lift to do anything.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, if you're trying to work with like some compiler technology or something, like leverage LLVM. Like, LLVM is like low language compiler toolkit.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can do amazing stuff. This is what Rust is built on. This is what so many of these like new Zig was built on. Like, they're all built on this stuff. But it's like, you know, you want to do a prototype 2 years and you got to be like a genius to do it. And like, so like, that's one extreme. And I look at Nostr, maybe the best part about it is it's like the other hard side of the bell curve where you can do something in half an hour, you know? And you can do something non-trivial in half an hour and deploy it and have people use it, right? Like, that's like one of the coolest things about Nostr is that you can like exercise this creative agency with, you like can't really get much output faster that will involve other people too. Like, you can do something that's only you on your computer, but a cool thing about Nostr is you can like make something, deploy it, and have somebody play with it. Like, we've done these demos at SEC where like somebody, like I think of Paul's hypertext thing, where he makes a stories thing that can like embed a dynamic widget for like a tip button inside this Instagram stories type UI, and he'll demo it, and there's the URL, and we can all pull up on our phones and like play with it, right? Yeah. Like that's
immediate and live. Yeah. It's like that's what always happens. Like someone demos something and shows something off, and if there is like a lightning invoice to pay someone, someone in the audience will pay it. If there is an interactive element, someone will immediately jump on that.
From a developer point of view, I think one of the best things about Nostr is that it's like one of the hardest things about any sort of like creative new like indie hacking style development is how do you get those first 100 users?
Yeah,
10 users. Like it's often like very difficult.
Yeah.
And that's the cool thing about Nostr is like in a sense your users already exist.
Yeah.
Like they're already off to your system.
Yeah.
They might have to hit a little button in their, you know, their Albi extension to use your thing, but like they already have a username and password to your database more or less, right? Like
It's also discovery is built in some sense.
It's like I
stumble over new Nostr apps and things all the time.
Yeah.
And it's just like out there in this strange universe and you can just very easily stumble upon
things. That's why, I mean, it's probably kind of, you know, if I put myself in the shoes of somebody listening to this and they're like, okay, Justin's here, he's going to talk about Bitcoin or something, and we haven't talked about Bitcoin, we just talk about LLMs all the time, which I don't really know that much
Bitcoin
about,
is assumed.
But it's that's why the LLM stuff is kind of, like in this cohort, I don't think we planned on talking about AI at all.
Not at all, no.
And that's all we're really talking about or doing. I think part of it is because it is a good, you know, we were thinking about talking about Nostr, and it is actually a good fit because like Nostr, you can, an LLM can spit out like a novel, cool, if you have an idea in Nostr, an LLM can spit out a demo in like 5 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, you can
and
actually
so that's, answer that. That's one of the reasons why, whereas like an LLVM engineer, like it's the complete opposite. We're like, this is useless.
Yeah.
Like I have to spend years to get anywhere. This might carve off a little time, but not much.
And it's even more than that. I hope to talk with Pablo about it soon. He is currently building out his whole kind of, you know, vibe coding LLM stack to use Nostr directly, not only in the DVM CP context where the MCP stuff is on Nostr, but also the output of his various tools is pushed to relays and other tools can grab it from there and he can interact with the nodes and the stuff that is produced on Nostr, where it's just like, here's the output, like to use your example, it's like, okay, here's what I built, here's the screenshot, and you see it on your phone, you reply to the note, and it picks it up again.
Yeah.
And so I think it's almost like
Nostr is a QA,
but
not like a stylistic QA, a product QA.
But we are, the beautiful thing I think about this is if it's out in the open, that's why I kind of hate DMs, and this was back in the Twitter days as well. Because if you and I talk with Pablo about this all the time, if you have a question for me, just ask out in the open, unless it's like super hyper confidential and so on. Yeah. Because I might not be the best person to answer it.
Yeah.
Someone else might pick it up and know it.
You
know
have a button that you can blast it to like 20,000 people.
Yeah. Just ask it out in the open, and I think for the LLM stuff as well, it's like, you know, other agents can pick it up, other things can pick it up. If you, for example, with your screenshot idea, it's like you show, that's why streaming is also a thing. It's very useful, you know, like you show what you're building, it posts screenshots and stuff or whatever snippets to Nostr. Yeah. People can comment on it, people can, you know, like even make it better. Like you can open up the prompting, for example, to a select group of people to you know, a certain subset of your web of trust or what have you. I think it's super interesting. I think it really is the perfect substrate for like a human agent environment.
Another interesting about this sort of like working in public, this basically is working in public idea, right?
Yeah.
Like another interesting thing, like I find that on Twitter very stressful because it's like at any moment you could
the mob comes.
Well, no, yeah, you could become the guy, like every once in a while someone does something stupid and they are the topic of conversation that day about how stupid they are, right?
Yeah.
And it's a little stressful to you know, to be one virality event away from that. But the like it requires a certain thick skin and also just you have to prepare yourself for that. I did it first to some, you know, like participated a lot on Twitter for a couple years, but I've basically flatlined my followers like 5 years now. I think I've gained like 50 followers in 5 years. I just stopped trying to
engage,
participate on the global. I mean, it's funny on the Nostr, like I stopped trying to participate at the global level, right? Like in the beginning I would try to tweet and try to get attention from people outside my circle.
Yeah.
And like 4 or 5 years ago, like I think it's during COVID, I just decided to stop. I just didn't really want to do that anymore. And the interesting thing about Nostr is that you can sort of live in public in a sense. It's easier because first of all, like Nostr doesn't really have virality to the same degree that Twitter does, right? Mm. Like,
yeah. You yet, can't, I would say, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, in a sense, there's no, you know, if there's no global, mm. right, to some extent, like, there is a friction against virality. There's a headwind to virality mm. on Nostr.
Fair, yeah.
Where Twitter actually has a tailwind, right? Like, they want, if there's yeah, yeah. something that yeah. is, like, eyeballable, yeah, they yeah. want that, they want everyone to see that, right? Yeah. Like, you know, like, Elon applies this to himself, right?
Yeah.
Like, he makes sure he's got a tailwind on all his tweets, right?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
they're being pushed out much more than they would organically. And so I think that's from like a living in public point of view, like if you're going to do stuff like streaming, because streaming is also kind of scary, right?
Mm.
It's like,
sure.
you know, like what if I actually pull up some of my notes that have some embarrassing anecdote or some stuff about anime that I don't want everyone to know that I like, you know, like, if, you know, it's kind of scary to have your computer
sure.
available
yeah.
to the internet, or what if I pull up my emails and,
yeah.
you know, like it is kind of nice that it's a smaller graph, you know,
yeah.
like there's some complaints about Nostr not growing a lot, but that's actually like, I found myself not using Twitter a lot much since I got to SEC. And part of it is because I like that there's enough people to talk to, there's enough people I like on Nostr, but there aren't that many more, you know? So like, I think in a sense it's a benefit of Nostr being like, I, you know, if Nostr grew very big and succeeded, quote unquote, in that sense, like, in some sense, I hope it would still be usable in a way that I'm in just a walled garden with 20,000 people,
yeah.
right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know if I want, I mean, unless I have something to sell, for example, like
yeah.
if you have something to sell, you'd much rather have a wider reach. But like, just for some sort of a quote unquote authentic uses, like, a smaller graph is more beneficial, right?
It's I think that's what Nostr XL said, and I think that's,
you know,
also
think of what the, like, the Piraeus or whatever, like the where Socrates taught, like
yeah.
the place where
yeah,
he
yeah.
would go on his walks, you know, down by the port in Athens. It's like, how many people were in that dialogic sphere?
Yeah.
50,000? 20,000? There weren't that many people.
We were limited by physical space for that, and I think we will also be, I think we see this emerging now on the internet, not only on Nostr, but I think that's what Nostr is.
Yeah.
It's like you're limited by intellectual space.
Yeah.
There's only so many people that can talk meaningfully,
yeah.
that can meaningfully participate in this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's gonna remain small by
default.
Well,
and also it's like there's not always like a right way for a thing to evolve, right? Like,
oh no,
there's many ways. Like that's what actual diversity is. It's like,
yeah.
if you segregate something off, like a physical organism, for like in Madagascar for 100 million years or something, it becomes interesting. You get like a lemur
yeah.
or something, right?
Yeah.
I think lemurs are from, or maybe they're from
yeah.
somewhere else, but like you get like an interesting thing, and so like. Like that's something like, you know, if Athens was the size of the United States,
yeah.
it would have never
become
a
different
Athens.
Thing. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like you could have never had what it was. And that's one of the things that's sort of disturbing about the modern world is it's like one village now. And
yeah.
so you don't actually get much, you know, like stuff can't really evolve and become like an interesting subculture to the same degree if it's on the global feed, right?
Because yeah.
everything gets pulled back to the mean.
I will link to this article as well with like how our interfaces and the world at large lost its texture, basically.
Yeah.
It's like everything looks the same. All the
yeah.
clothes look the same. I mean,
yeah.
we're wearing the same stuff.
Yeah, we are literally dressed almost the same.
We look the same.
Yeah.
But that's true for
the
almost everyone.
Looks the same.
Yeah, it's all the same. It's like we all have the same devices. Everyone has the same cars. Everyone has kind
if
of
I
the same
If I had a beard, like I grew
really,
a beard, it looks
really,
roughly like yours does. We would look like the same guy.
Really, it's really bad. And so I think there's something to that. But I think it's also interesting how, for example, there was this distinct difference between Twitter and Bitcoin Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all these bubbles inside Twitter that were purely, it was not because
yeah.
of a space constraint. It was only because of a kind of a intellectual conversational constraint. It's
yeah.
it's just like the your social graph, basically,
yeah.
and that the topics would naturally clump. You had like
yeah.
fintech Twitter.
I mean,
like
it was the same
kind of
anti-entryism thing where like we'd speak
yeah.
in memes and stuff. Where
yeah, exactly.
And
memes
like
are coded language
almost,
for exactly
you
that.
Almost
yeah.
purposefully, I mean, like Pierre Richard is like
yeah.
the person who kind of helped me understand
yeah.
this, where it's
yeah.
like, no, the echo chamber is good.
Absolutely.
Like I cultivate
yeah.
an echo chamber.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
like that is one thing that I think that allowed Bitcoin Twitter to become sort of
yeah.
an interesting place, and I would
yeah.
say it kind of produced Nostr in some sense,
yeah.
right? Like
you know Bitstein's talk of how to meme Bitcoin to the
yeah,
moon
yeah,
or something.
I was in the room
for
that.
Yeah,
I was the next talk, actually, so I didn't enjoy
really?
It at all. because I hadn't really prepared my slides. No one remembers my talk, of course.
Everyone remembers Bitsyn's talk.
I was sitting in the corner trying to get my slides right.
No, but they identified this earlier than anyone else. And I think on the Nostra side, we have the same effect now. It's just like one big bubble, more or less. I mean, there's other bubbles on Nostra. There's like the art people.
Yeah.
There's like the jungle people. There's like the farmer people.
The jungle people are like the one of the things that I can't understand if that's just purely... Primal and Jack.
No. They were there before.
The skeptic in me thinks it's a paid
I know why all of this is kind of happening in some sense, or I at least my explanation for it is like Bitcoin monetized and expanded on the fringes, on the edges.
Yeah.
It's like you had to be crazy to be an early Bitcoiner. Yeah. Like kind of you had to either live through hyperinflation or be an Austrian or be debanked
and
or those kind of things. Like very edges of society, multiple edges, but still very edge of society. And I think on the Nostra side it's similar now. That's why we have the crazy, you know, like health people that think that blue light is so toxic that you should never ever see watch anything blue, running around with red sunglasses at all times. Yeah. And it's like that's very fringe kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I'm not gonna mention absolutely all the fringes because it's just like too out there. But all the out there people are there. And it's like just living in the jungle, going barefoot, rising with the sun, going to sleep with the sun, never touching any processed food ever. That's kind of fringe in our today's society.
Yeah.
And so I think they are naturally attracted to Nostr. And it's also
what about Nostr do you think attracts them? I have an answer for this, but why what is the shared would you agree that there's some shared trait of Nostr?
I think because it's raw and it's true and it requires some work.
Yeah.
It's and I wanted to come back to that, the realness. People really crave realness, and Nostr and Bitcoin as well. It's very real. It's like you can feel kind of that it's not manipulated by an algorithm. It's not manipulated by
ads.
A big tech thing or by ads or by influencers.
No one's making money
off
this, and
no one tries to sell you something.
People everyone's engagement in this is probably at the pure loss of economic.
Absolutely, economic loss. Yeah.
Every minute I spend trying to develop on Nostr,
I
could be making money selling AI to a small.
But not only that, I never spend money on software ever in my life. Like I always hated that thought.
Yeah.
I'm spending so much money on Nostr right now.
Yeah.
Paid relays.
Yeah.
Running my own servers. Yeah. Paid file hosting.
I started doing
this. I SAP all the time.
It was funny. I had I was using the Primal web client because again I'm not a power user, so I can use like 2-3 tools, and this fucking thing wouldn't allow me to upload an MP4.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the apps it can, right? I think.
I don't know. But yes.
You have
I
an,
also
iPhone,
use an iPhone.
So
it's almost impossible
to files.
It's almost impossible to get a fucking MP4 onto my phone. Like, literally
it's
almost
just
impossible.
A camera roll.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I
it's
know.
Almost impossible.
I was
struggling for a long time.
Yeah.
And finally, I was like, what's that? Like, it's not Nostr.build or something.
Yeah.
So I pulled up that because I knew that this could do this. And it's like, what is it, like $100 a year? I paid $100 a year. I paid $100 to upload an MP4 of Terry Davis typing into the CIA website that he's going to kill them.
Let's go.
Like, CIA, you're all going to, this is King Terry, you're all going to die. The hand of God.
You are the fringe that Nostr is attracting.
Yeah,
right
I paid $100 for that. I felt pretty good about it.
That's, like, by the way, that's the reason why I switched away from the iPhone like 10 years ago or so, because I just wanted to drag and drop an MP3 file on my phone, and it was impossible.
Dude, it's so
hard.
It was
literally impossible.
So hard.
And so I gave up and switched.
And it's so funny, because that was the entire premise of the whole thing in the beginning. This is a drag and drop MP3 experience. Now it's like you can't even do it
anymore.
You can't.
You own nothing.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to get a graphene phone and try. Like, every time Vitor and that final guy on Nostr, he's one of my favorite followers, the graphene dev.
Yeah.
Whenever they talk about graphene, it is like, that is actually pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
I run graphene on all my phones.
Yeah. It is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm going to definitely... You know, when I get back home, I'm going to buy one of those and set
but
it up.
But in the same vein, you're saying you're not a power user, so I'm not sure how much fun you're going to have. Because it is a power user kind of thing. You will have to tinker with it, and you will have to spend a lot of time.
I mean, at the same
it
time,
right,
it's like I did just give up Cursor, which everything works, to try to do everything on the command line
fair
with
enough.
NeoVim. And like I spent this week, like we got to go do demos in a couple hours, and I have like nothing. Like I've been all week, last Tuesday, I was about ready to start making a phone call app. Like, I have the whole setup, I have the whole, all the prompts ready, to build a, like, yeah, literally a audio, like, encrypted audio call and end
I
hub.
Have the prompts ready.
Like, no, yeah. Literally, I
it's
have,
basically
I
done.
Have this app is fucking chambered. Like, I spent a whole weekend going back and forth. I have this really, it's perfect. Like, everything is ready. Like, I figured out exactly the libraries to use, how to do it in all Rust. Like, the only thing my UI needs is buttons. Like, I don't have to do any Kotlin to integrate with the audio system. I don't have to, I use one Google library. If you should use Kotlin, you use WebRTC, which is this massive Google, it's like 11 components or something, massive C++ code base, impossible to cross, like really hard to cross compile. It's funny, like WebRTC is this web standard, right? So it's the idea that you make a standard and different browsers implement it. Like Safari and Firefox did not have enough money to write this, so they just fucking run Google C++ code in their browser.
So like Blue Sky works.
It's kind of insane. Like it's kind of insane. Like it's like learning about this. And so I figured out
there's one company who made a standard, one company that had enough money to implement it, and one
and it's just a
one company
block
that runs
box.
It.
Yeah. And so my thing is like I'm still going to use the audio processing. Like, that's one thing that that is really good is they have this like noise cancellation library where like you can make the calls sound really crisp. So that's the one thing I'm going to use. And everything else, it's much simpler things. And it's using the same underlying library that Fedimint just integrated to make it so you can do peer-to-peer connections with the Guardians so the Guardians don't need DNS names, which is one of the worst things about Fedimint is that you need to the Guardians need to get DNS names. And with one of the federations, I forget which one it was, they had XYZ things and the registrar banned them.
Yeah.
So I think they ended up, being able to sort that whole thing out, but it was really annoying. And that's just because it was integrating with this dying Web 2.0 infrastructure that is it's kind of dying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
it's one of the biggest issues of the web is DNS. And
I
hope that Nostr, I hope that we can just switch to NPUPs, basically.
Yeah.
And I don't care how it resolves underneath.
Yeah.
I really don't care. It's
so
just
I think this is called IRO. Like, it's a cool way to I think there's some DHT that you can use to connect nodes to so they can establish a, it's a very much like hole punch but it's not written in JavaScript, which is nice. and it doesn't have to have its own runtime, and it so that is, and so like that thing Fiat Jeff posted the other day, this new social network
built by one guy
guy who did, I'm sure, did most of the stuff for Fedimint, DPC. He's an unbelievably good programmer. He's just one of these Rust purists.
Yeah.
So he's just Nostr sucks because it has JSON, right? Yeah. He hates the part that I think is the killer app that you can get to, you go from idea to implementation in 5 minutes. That's the part he doesn't like, because he's this unbelievably good programmer.
Yeah. But that's also, it's optimizing for the wrong thing, because his stuff is also purely peer-to-peer.
Yeah.
And that's extremely misguided. I think it was a deep insight by Fiat Jeff to actually use relays and use them as dumb servers, because my phone is offline most of the time.
Yeah.
So peer-to-peer stuff, just if you try running peer-to-peer stuff on your phone and 95% of people are on their phone, it doesn't work.
But the cool thing for an audio call is that it can be I think it can be better, because you can establish a peer-to-peer connection.
Absolutely. That's
in response to a push notification.
It's a different use case if you're actually calling, you're actually using your device.
Rostra thing and then the Fedimint thing kind of opened my eyes to this new library, and I'm damn, that would be good for making a phone. Like, just a phone.
Because
Nostr doesn't have a phone.
Yeah.
That's one of the things, these Unix tools, is I think about, how could I, how could you have a phone that just replaces all, why isn't there a camera app?
But that shows, but that also shows you what Nostr already is. Nostr is the global address book. That's the one first thing, in the first cohort, actually, you build into the Mutiny guys built the social money sending into the Fedimint stuff that they had and so on.
Yeah.
It's I want to send money to Justin.
Yeah.
I want to call Justin.
Yeah.
I want to send an encrypted DM to Justin.
Yeah.
I want to ask a question and tag Justin.
I think about Nostr is you look at your phone and to me, Nostr is, in a sense, it's the desktop itself and the contact book.
That's why, so far,
growing more and more of, it's populating more and more of these apps.
And that's why,
white noise is the messaging thing, right? It's great. You have this empty desktop and you have the fucking contact book, which is ironically,
it's an abstraction layer.
In the 2010 era of Silicon Valley technology, that was the one thing they would just fight to try to get into your contacts, right? That's what every Facebook and Snapchat is like. The one thing they needed from you is access to your address book, because then they could bootstrap their social network.
Yeah.
Without that, they couldn't figure out who you know in order to give you a good experience.
Yeah.
But it's the Nostr developer experience, the contact book comes stock,
yeah,
which
comes
is pretty important.
And I think that's exactly right. And it's like one abstraction layer higher in some sense. It's very, very much like what I just said. Is like I just want to talk to an NPUB. I don't care what is used underneath and how it resolves, whether it's Tor or IP. Yeah. I really don't care.
The devs can figure that out.
Yeah. And so that's one abstraction layer. The other abstraction layer is like I don't care what client I use. I don't care what DM client I use. Yeah. I don't care what I use to edit my profile metadata or those kind of things. And the way I see it expanding now, that's why it's my dream flow. I want to get a new phone. I don't care what phone it is. And I want to punch in my Nostr identity in whatever way. Let's say it's like 12 words. I want to punch in the 12 words and everything is there.
Yeah.
Same for, I'm sure you have a sophisticated like dot file setup.
Yeah.
And those kind of things.
Yeah.
And if you change machines.
I was rice farming most of the week this week.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And so wouldn't it be awesome if it's just like you everything is almost like a thin client, you know?
Yeah,
you
go
there, you log in with your Nostr identity, and it grabs all the right things.
Yeah.
It knows what your dot file setup is, it knows how you want your IDE to have set up and so on.
Yeah.
And that's it. And in that context it sets everything up for you. And
that's actually one of the things I was playing around with and that I wanna that I did this because I made like a Nix flick for Xcode.
Oh,
right?
I saw so
this
that,
is
yeah.
a, this is an idea where like if you wanna like I've been trying to make I'm calling it Rust multi-platform. So it's like this like basically like how it's kind of like some of my learnings from when we built Fetty, this app, you know, it's a mobile app, right? Like if I had to build a similar kind of mobile app again, how would I want to do things differently, right? And so like one thing that I would like to do differently, and not saying like Fetty's bad or anything, right? It's like it's any kind of project you learn stuff from it, right? And you think like what would you do next time? And so like, you know, we had a lot of logic in, like what I want to do, like there's this big kind of quest in development and I don't think it's solvable. Like there's no solution, but there are trade-offs, right? Right? So there's not like.
What do you look at that?
Yeah. This is not a paid post.
Paid advertisement.
This is not a paid advertisement, you know, there's no solution. So it's not like a thing where you're going to solve cross-platform development. But I think there's other trade-offs that aren't explored. So like one thing people do for a mobile app is, and the thing you can do the base thing is you'd write two different apps, right? You write one for iOS, one for Android, and they're completely separate. This is what, for example, Primal does, right? But in a sense, they offload a lot of their solution is actually to do it on a server, right? They have this caching server that actually has, like a lot of their actual business logic is in Postgres functions.
Yeah.
To populate a cache ahead of time for what your client will see. So their cross-platform development is literally Postgres functions, which I think technically is a really cool, novel trade-off, right? Like I think that's kind of interesting. Like on another one, but you know the actual app development is they have two separate apps, which is why sometimes the iOS app is significantly worse than the Android or vice versa, right? Like they don't have the same experience and they have one for web. So they have three different apps, right? So you can see how that would slow down velocity a lot, right? Where it's like, this week we're implementing some feature. We're implementing Blossom. Okay, all the devs go and do the same thing in different languages.
Yeah.
That's kind of what they have to do, right? Yeah. So in a perfect world, you would have to do less of that, you know? And so another option is like React Native. So there's this big thing like 15 years ago where Facebook is like, well, what if you could just write it all in JavaScript? It's kind of like the Nostr of social networks in a sense. Like, what if all these web devs can like make mobile apps? Wouldn't that be cool? But it came at somewhat of a cost. It's like JavaScript's not always the best language. And now you have to have a whole runtime. You like kind of embed a browser, at least the JavaScript part of a browser, and the HTML and the CSS part of a browser into your mobile app. So you have this huge kind of runtime and complexity cost in order to get
which
this.
Which is also, it always was a real cost, and that's why the apps always felt sluggish.
Yeah, they feel sluggish.
You can't feel the difference
between. The experience with React Native because I've built a few React Native projects in the past, like, you know, Fetty was one, and I've done a couple other ones. And the experience is like you launch quickly, like you get off to a good start. It's like a projectile, though, right?
Yeah.
You launch quickly, and over time, your vertical velocity
absolutely.
Decreases, right?
Yeah. Also, and what I experience is like the closer you have to be to the hardware itself, basically, the harder stuff gets, and it's just like you'll end up writing native modules anyway.
And now you have this whole abstraction layer that you're not even using anymore.
Yeah.
So like that's one solution, and Flutter is kind of the same thing with some technical details, but from Google, and there's some pros and cons.
Vitor had a great point, by the way, just yesterday. Vitor from Amethyst, discussing like what it means to build something in a native way. What does it mean to be native?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was excellent because
I didn't see that.
Because it's basically a dig on Will, like trying to write everything as low level as he can and writing his own like gaming rendering engine for the Nostra client and like rewriting the GIF rendering and absolutely everything. You have to rewrite everything from scratch, and that's kind of like what it means when we say native is like, I want my iOS app to feel like an iOS app.
I want
my Android app to feel like an Android app. Yeah. And here's the thing, and I think that's why it was such an excellent point.
It's a very overloaded word.
But he didn't expand on it properly. So I'm gonna try, because the thing is like, you're so close to the metal, and you're trying to achieve one thing. In Will's case, it's like he wants to build the most
he wants to rotate the cube.
in the most performant way possible, which is fair. It's like, you know, like you're like a 300 FPS cube. Yeah. It's perfectly fine.
He's the programmer I will never be.
Yeah, same for me. And I have no interest in stopping him. And the stuff he's building out with the LLM stuff and so on, it's amazing. Like If you want to stop someone like Will, you're retarded. Like just
he's
let him
an
go.
Example of that divergent evolution, though, right?
Yeah.
Like it is good that he's doing that.
And he should do all the thing. But my point about the native apps is like, does your app work with a screen reader for blind people?
Yeah.
Does it work on the Android fridge, you know, that someone is using and those kind of things?
Yeah.
And it's like, you have no idea how much heavy lifting the OS is doing for you.
Animation as you scroll between tabs feel like the other, like
exactly.
That's where the actual native feel.
All the gestures work.
Like this is like Flutter. I can oftentimes tell a Flutter app because they do, like, the difference between React Native and Flutter is React Native has this runtime to execute your code, and then you produce basically HTML, and the system itself maps your HTML to native components. Yeah. So it is able to feel a little more native because it's actually using like native scrolls.
Yeah.
And then what Flutter does is they just have a canvas that they just draw pixels to.
Exactly.
And so they're able to, they have more control in a sense, but it's also not native components. So you can kind of, every once in a while you kind of feel like that doesn't feel like Android.
But,
and you don't even, might not notice it, but it, like that doesn't feel native.
But if you use a screen reader because you're blind, you really notice because it stops working.
Yeah.
If you use it in a different language.
And the only reason that this kind of works for Flutter is that, what do you think they're, dev costs is on a yearly basis to produce this? Hundreds of millions of dollars, I would guess, right?
Yeah.
Like, I saw some crazy thing. There's this really interesting guy, what's his name? He's making Ladybird, this new browser.
I thought the movie.
No. Really interesting guy. He, Serenity, what's his name?
I don't know.
Yeah, so he was like an addict, and he was doing, he was a browser engineer who got addicted to drugs. He's very public about it. And he's like, he's doing the 12 steps, and he's like, okay, in order to stop doing drugs, I'm going to write an operating system, right?
Like the Temple OS guy?
Yeah, no. It's very similar. He's one of these very admirable people. Like, he's one of the best streamers on YouTube. I wish I could remember his name. I see his face, but I can't remember his name. And he started streaming it. And so he started with nothing and started making, his idea was like, the two best things in operating system are the Unix command line and 90s, you'll like this, 90s Windows applications, because it had like a very
Windows 95 stuff.
Extremely usable software, actually, and it was texture.
Allow me to go on this tangent, because that's when they built the UI things, they figured out so many things. How are you quick with a mouse? Okay, I'll tell you some things that stopped working while computers evolved. We broke so many things. Okay, so for example, the scroll bars.
Yeah.
They were always visible. You could always see at a glance where you were.
Yeah.
Now we are hiding them.
Yeah.
Okay, the little X.
And it's a little different on every app.
Yeah.
Like Firefox is different from Chrome.
The little X. What is there? They did all these studies. They put so much thought into all this stuff, like the Windows 95 UI, the general, like all this UI stuff that came out of, you know, like fucking Bell Labs and all those kind of things. Also, how the mouse works, all those kind of things. They put so much thought into it. So they figured out what are the five positions that the user can access most quickly with a mouse.
Yeah.
And it's like top left corner, top right corner, bottom left corner, bottom right corner.
Yeah.
Because you can throw your mouse in that direction.
Yeah.
You don't have to point. You can just throw and click.
Yeah.
That's why when a window is maximized, the close button is in the top right corner. Yeah. You can throw it, click it, and the window is closed. In modern operating systems, the button is round and the hit box doesn't expand to the top right pixel.
Yeah.
And so you actually can't do that anymore. So it's completely besides the point.
Yeah, yeah.
And the most important pixel in terms of mouse that you have is where the mouse cursor is at right now. So if right a dialogue there. Pops up, yeah. it should pop up below the mouse, and the mouse should be on the OK button or whatever, those kind of things. Yeah. And old UI systems did this, and they did this perfectly. Yeah. And they also had hotkeys for everything, for example, where it's just like, you know, like Control F or Alt F or whatever, it was this file. And it had discoverability for hotkeys, where it in the menus it showed you the hotkeys are underlined, and it would just work, and you could... You could get so good and so quick at using those interfaces, and we destroyed all of that just because we wanted to have it, like, the designers came in and broke it.
No, it's like, the designers displaced the power users.
Yeah, and because we literally had, like, form follows function, and now we really don't have that anymore.
I want to look up this guy's name just because I think the listeners might actually like this. But, yeah, so he started making, what's his name? He started making this browser or this operating system, Andreas Kling. Yeah, he's great YouTube. So for example, one of his YouTube videos, he's like, we don't have a browser, and I don't want to cross-compile. Like, I don't really, maybe he did port, like, Chrome or some Firefox or something. He's like, okay, we ported it, but, like, it doesn't fit in. I don't like it. We need our own. So he that's what he does. He just, like, literally rewrites everything. This operating system has zero dependencies.
Zero. So it is like TempOS.
Yeah. No, it's literally like TempOS, right? And it has zero dependencies.
Is he as insane as the TempOS guy?
In some ways more, in some ways less, right? Like, you know, I think he's more insane because he actually is trying to do this, whereas I don't think Terry Davis was actually trying to get people to use this operating system. This guy, to some extent, is. And now, so he did this great stream where he's like, we need a browser. So let's see, how do you tokenize JavaScript? Or I think he had a browser. He had an HTML browser, and then maybe they added CSS. And I was like, okay, we can't do anything dynamic in our browser. He has like a 1995 browser. He's like, well, we need JavaScript. So he Googles tokenized JavaScript, and then he Googles like Hello World JavaScript, and he pastes the Hello World code into the tokenizer, and he's like, okay, so here's the token. So let's go into C++ and let's make a struct, and he starts like copying over the struct. And like names the, you know, let's make a token for function, let's make a token for closure, like for the namespace, right? And so he slowly, you can see how he started by a Hello World function, tokenizing a Hello World function, which any dev can do. And then they just iterated that on a couple of years, and now it's Lady Bird browser, which they have taken out of browser project, and now they're actually trying to make this to be a new browser implementation. And so now they did take on dependencies. They use curl for networking. They have a couple dependencies like that, maybe libgl for certain things. And they're trying, they have like a $1 or $2 million budget. And this is why I thought of this. Guess what Google Chrome's budget is?
Hundreds.
$2 or $3 billion per year. And these guys are doing it like $1 or $2 million dollars, and they're doing a from scratch browser implementation. And the thing that's so inspiring about it is he has one talk, but he's like, you know, most people overestimate what they can do, what did he say? That was a different one. People kind of overestimate or underestimate what you can do I can't remember exactly. If you kind of just keep going. Like people always say, you can't build a browser. Like that was kind of tribal wisdom in programming. And he's like, well, watch me. I'm just going to start from tokenizing JavaScript. And now they're like pretty close to having, like, they can render a lot of websites. They can kind of render Discord. They can kind of render Twitter.
Wow.
Like they're getting pretty close. And it's kind of an inspirational project of how far a small team can go if they just really try hard.
Sure. I mean, that's impressive. How many people are
like
on the team?
Five or something. Okay. I mean, it's a big community, but like there's a few people that work on it full time.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, it's just this massive. Yeah. I mean, you truly do kind of see though how, I mean, it is still possible to build a browser like they're doing it, but it's like, man, we kind of went overboard with
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. Absolutely.
You kind of, it's in a sense like the web got re-architected. Absolutely. Yeah. This is why the WebRTC example is a good example. It's like, in a sense, the web was kind of re-architected so that it could be a walled garden.
Yeah.
Right? Like as soon as you add WebRTC to the whatever IETF spec for the web, it is no longer something that even Apple can participate in as an equal member, right? Because for WebKit, they just run the C++ code from Google.
Mm.
They can't. It does not make sense for Google, a multi-trillion dollar or Apple, a multi-trillion dollar company, to re-implement that. So you
insane,
can't.
Right?
You know, like in a sense, it's like wow. That's a very insightful example.
But just think about it for a minute. It's like the basically the most valuable company on earth.
Yeah.
they have like infinite money for all intents and purposes, and it doesn't make economic sense for them to re-implement it.
No, yeah, yeah. In a sense too, it's like this ethos of having independent browser vendors is kind of dying a little bit. Like, you know, you used to have Internet Explorer. For all of its faults, at least it was an independent implementation. Edge is Chromium.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's you're loser. Yeah. Even Microsoft threw in the hat on having a browser implementation, right? So that's another way. The more I think about, learn about Nostr, because again, I'm kind of a noob. I mostly ignored it for the past couple of days. But one of the things that strikes me is how the legacy, it's not just like the walled gardens of the like FAANG companies that are kind of maybe
the
dying.
Technology in and of itself.
The platform in and of itself is dying, right? Like, it is dying.
Yeah.
And these are examples of it dying.
Yeah,
like it is atrophying.
Yeah,
it's dying, and
for multiple reasons.
Hopeless,
I think,
in some sense.
I I also sometimes watch like various, you know, streamers and things and those kind of things.
And this is kind of one of the, like, we talked a couple months ago, and you were talking about how like Nostr is the kind of the new internet in a sense, right? And
so
I had idea what you were talking about.
Yeah,
you
thought
said
I was crazy. Yeah.
No. I mean, I knew you're not crazy because I've known you for a long time. But I did spend like a month or two kind of trying to think, like, what the fuck is he talking about? Because I know you're not crazy, but I did not understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And these are some of the things where I've been kind of like, I think this is kind of gives me a similar feeling.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's our opportunity to go back to the drawing board and kind of deeply think about why are we doing the things that we're doing currently on the web.
Yeah.
And would there be a better way?
Yeah.
What if we would go back to ground zero and build it from scratch, basically?
Yeah.
That's how I look at Nostr. Because in the end, it's like lots of the web that we have now. It is kind of, it's very simple things done in a very, 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 very complicated way. And I talked with Paul about this. That's why I'm so excited about Hypernode and the idea of it. Because it's like, to render a Twitter, the things we need to do, the stuff you mentioned, rendering Discord, rendering Twitter itself, the things we need to do to render Twitter, to render the Twitter feed in the browser,
it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
Like, if you guys are, if anyone listening is technical, you should watch some of these Andreas Kling talks or his streams where he does this. It's like, you understand, like, this guy is fucking brilliant, and he spent years, and these websites still barely render.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
and
unbelievable.
Compare it to Nostr, where you can write, like, a client in any language and render it on, like, a terminal, and you basically have the same effect.
Yeah.
I just want to see short text notes from my friends.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, that's true across the stack. It's like, I want to share an image. I want to share a live stream.
This is a cool thing about what Will is doing, is that in a sense, he's kind of working in the same area where this is like, in a sense, I think it's still like
it shouldn't be a fucking DOM.
Well, it's very half. I think his thing is still very half baked, still, which is not a like.
No,
a dig
I mean
at
he's
all.
A genius in my book. He has
but
the
it,
right
but
idea.
It's like it is like a browser-ish like kind of runtime
that
he's making, which is
but that's the thing
sense.
About it. That's why I think the insight from Vitor was so great, because it's like you have to find the balance of going back to the drawing board and redoing things and like not reinventing the wheel.
Like
you don't actually wanna do everything from scratch.
Yeah, let me get back to my Rust multi-platform idea. So, like, I talked about some different, like, one thing is you just make a different app on every platform. So now you have three code bases, like Primal, right? That's one way of doing it. And then there's the React Native, where you get one thing, but then it often becomes kind of sluggish and it gets hard to use because it's this JavaScript language is not, it's a shitty language, kind of, but, you know, they added TypeScript on top of it, which makes it significantly better at the cost of another abstraction layer. So now, like, JavaScript is a compilation target. Like, in the sense that LLMs are turning React into TypeScript, React into a compilation target. So you're getting more and more and more and more and more and more, and more, and more layers of complexity, which is not good. And it's one of the things that's cool about what Will's doing is because, like, he has two layers of complexity.
Yeah.
He has, like, pixels, and
he draws them to the
screen 60 times a second, right? Yeah. So in a sense, that's a really cool thing about what he's doing is that, like, the layers of complexity are, he's, like, cut through many layers of complexity, which is, I think, promising on a long-term time frame.
Oh, absolutely.
And this is another approach you can do. This is what, like, video, this is probably how a YouTube app works, right?
Yeah.
Like, when you're watching a video, that is rendered, there's C code in the app that is shared on the iOS and mobile, and you know, the app itself just gets, like, a buffer 60 times a second from C and just paints it to the screen.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's probably their cross-platform strategy. There's another really interesting one that Facebook did for Messenger, where they had basically what Primal has, two totally separate apps. They had like 1.5 million lines of code in each one, just massive applications, and it just became difficult to maintain. And these were using the old versions of mobile development, like Objective-C and Java, which have been supplanted by a new way of doing it with Swift.
I still remember the brackets of
Objective-C. It's horrible. And so what they did is they rewrote their applications, but they tried to put as much as possible into a shared C++ library, where as much of the state of the application as possible is written into SQLite. Mm. And so the front end basically just looks for what page are we on in SQLite and just renders that. Yeah. So it's a little bit like what Will's doing, where it just renders it from SQLite.
That's why he built DustDB, right? Mm-hmm. Like he wanted to have the most performant way possible.
So what Will's doing is actually very similar to how Facebook Messenger works, one of the like top five most used apps in the world. Instead of NostraDB, it uses SQLite. I mean, SQLite's better in some ways because it's like it's probably the most deployed piece of software in the world. It's in your phone, it's in your car, it's in your fridge, it's everywhere. But the cool thing about NostraDB is that it's kind of like an in-memory database. So like, as you write to it, it's still in memory, and so it's able to render straight from. It doesn't have to come from disk. It's just straight in memory all the time, so that it's as fast as you could possibly get. That's another approach. And so the way I would like to do it is, which I haven't seen many people doing, is I would like to write as much of my application as possible in one language, all the logic and all the state, like what page am I on, is the button disabled, is it not disabled, are we in a loading state, is there an error message, what's the user's name, stuff like that, like what is the whole state of what should be rendered. I want that in one language that is really good at cross-platform stuff, and ideally has a lot of libraries. It's really fast, and so I would like that to be Zig, just because I have done a lot of Rust and I got kind of sick of it. But Zig doesn't have libraries, and LLMs don't understand it. So I ended up doing it in Rust because it's just so much more mature, and there's so many great libraries, especially in the Bitcoin and Nostra world. Like any library, if there is a library, there's one in Rust.
Yeah.
And this is actually one of the things that turned me off on WebRTC, is I was going to try to do this calling thing, and I was like, well, let's do WebRTC. There's no Rust implementation. Mm. Like that, to me, it's like, if there's not a Rust implementation of something, a grassroots Rust implementation of something by now, you shouldn't use it. Because it's fucking too complicated. It's too fucking complicated. And so that kind of turned me off on WebRTC. That was the first thing that made me think WebRTC might not be a good idea. But so that's what I want to do it all in Rust, and then I want to just actually render to the screen with whatever the standard thing is on that platform. Like, so whatever Apple says in their presentations you should use, I want to use that. Because that's native, not in the sense of speed necessarily, because that one way native can be is like, is it fast? Like, that's one sense in which people use native. The other sense is like,
UI, UX.
Does it feel look like feel everything else, right? Yeah, yeah. So I want to use Swift UI to render it. I want to use Jetpack Compose on Android because that's what they use.
How do you do the translation? You need to have a wrapper
On web, like if I did it on web, and this is a little iffy, but use React because that's just what everyone does, right? Mm-hmm. And so you need a way to make Rust be able to run Rust code in that context. So the cool thing is, Rust originally started as a project to attempt to, browsers have a lot of security vulnerabilities, and because they're written in C and C++, which are not sort of security. They weren't built for security from the beginning, and so they just tend to have a lot of memory safety bugs that Rust was invented to fix. And so it was invented by Mozilla, and so they built really good tooling to run Rust inside their iOS app, their Android app. So it's this project called UniFFI that allows you to do that. It helps you cross-compile your code to run on that platform. So you write Rust code, and then you build it, and then it can run on iOS, and then it also generates types, so you can the code that you can run is easily callable from Swift or from Kotlin, so you can pass some object representing the user, and you can pass around your application where you want to paint to the screen. So that's what I figured out kind of how to do this, and it was it was like a couple hundred lines of code to make a simple example. But I wanted to simplify it as much as possible. So I got it down, like this is like the first 2 weeks. I got it down so it's like in Rust you have to define three things. You have to define a message that the Rust could pass to the front end, like basically the state change. So we have a user now. We didn't have a user. They logged in with their input. Now we have a user, right?
Yeah.
Another thing is like something that the UI can send to Rust. Like, hey, the user clicked a button.
right? Do something. You know, the user, it's usually stuff that based on user activity. And then you have to have something in Rust that will handle these you know, incoming events from the UI and send events in the other end. And so that's one struct or enum. It can be either one. I think it's only structs now, but it could be enums. And so that is basically a struct where you have one thing that you handle messages and you react to them, right? And so it's really simple. It's like three things you have to understand. And a hello world can be like, I think we got to 60 lines. I got to 60 lines of code, and I was able to generate a lot of the code that is needed to sort of do these bridging things.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, you know.
So the translation from what is in the database to the UI is kind of basically vibe codable.
Yeah. My library generates it kind of.
Okay.
More or less, like you have this struct that's in memory. And I had another version that was in SQLite, like this messenger thing.
But what's contained in the struct is like, because some of the UI elements between the platforms differ, right? So
it's this. Like, it's just like, what page are we on? What?
But who,
you know, are
who
we
renders? Who does the translation from a page of how does the top navigation bar look? Because on iOS you have the little.
So you can think of it this way, like you're
building up a stack of views, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so you'll have a stack of views with the data that is associated with them, and then your rendering in Swift UI or Jetpack Compose gets that. You can think of it as a struct or a JSON object, and it'll look at the top one, and that's what's on the top of
The view will also have a title, and so because iOS displays the title, for example, Android doesn't.
It's exactly the same as what Vitor is doing on. It's like the coding, it's actually presenting the page. Is probably exactly what Amethyst does. It's just whatever that you do in Android, like whatever the standard thing is, and you're just doing it based on data that is. It's in like a view model. It's in. Some, I think it's called like composable or something in Jetpack Compose. So it's basically a type of struct that can notice when attributes change, right? So like you can have stuff where like if you have your state in Rust and it changes, you have to somehow tell the front end that something changed that need to re-render. That's if you have a reactivity. It's basically like, when did my data change? When should I paint again?
Yeah.
Will doesn't have this problem because when does he paint again? Yeah. 60 times a second he paints, no matter what. Like he doesn't have to notice if something changed because as soon as he's done painting, he starts painting again.
Yeah.
All he does is paint, you know? He just paint. That's all Will does, and you know, that's what his app does. That's why it's so fast. So my library generates all this for you. So you don't even see any of that shit. Mm. You just see this data structure that your editor understands. You can jump to definition, see what the types mean. You can autocomplete stuff, and so you say what page are we on? Okay, then render that page in the Swift UI or Jetpack Compose router. Okay, we're on that page. What is the user's name? Put that in there. You know, it's purely declarative, and all you do is given this piece of data, you draw with how they do it. And so the cool thing about this. Like one reason I don't want to do the way that, like, for say, Primal does it is that I don't want to write three UIs.
Yeah.
Like, if I want to write an app, I would like it to run multiple places, and I am not going to learn. I'm not going to learn Swift. I am not going to learn Kotlin. I'm not going to do that. But I am willing to learn a little bit about the DSL for how to lay out a page because that's much simpler than the language itself, right? You don't have to understand concurrency. You don't have some memory. You don't have some garbage collection. You don't have some fucking anything. And in general, if you set up the tools well enough, which is what I've been working on since then, when I was talking about these MCPs, I think you should get to a point where you can basically vibe code the entire UI.
Yeah.
So what you're actually engineering mostly is the logic. Like, when I get an event, what should my events be, right? Like, what are the events that the user can trigger, and what are the effects that I can present to them after that's happening? Like a loading state, or like the post is published and now you're looking at the post, right?
Yeah.
So you think about that and how to handle it, and you know, you write your logic in Rust, and then you get just a very simple thing that you can tell an LLM to, you know, render this drawing I made.
Yeah.
You know, and so I did this. I did one demo with this, which was like an eCash wallet. That I was able to, I made an Excaladraw for the flow of the app. It had like seven pages, and I took this Excaladraw and I gave it to an LLM and said implement this, and it implemented that. It had it did like two or three things wrong, but I was able to comment them out. Like I had a history thing that you're supposed to swipe up to get it. Mm-hmm. It didn't get that, and it put two screens in the wrong order. I just reordered them manually, and then it was basically what I drew.
Insane.
Yeah. It was insane, yeah. And so, like, so I think this, it's a good fit for LLM tools, because it's like, you still need software. You're not, I don't really believe in the world where you have really high quality apps that are purely produced by a computer. Like, I don't think that's realistic, at least now. But I think parts of it can be produced by a computer. And the one thing that they're really, really good at is making UIs.
Yeah.
And so that's the, like, so you can get, like, so a lot of the vibe coding, like, aha moments are when you try to make, like, a little, like, one, like, 500 line React app. Yeah. It can one shot those. But if you have, like, a 10,000 line React app and you try to add a feature, it's going to get lost. But, like, so can you make a big, complicated app where, at least on the UI side, it's very simple? And all the data is there, and there's an LSP for it to tell it if it's the linting's wrong, and it can screenshot the UI to see if it matches up with the flows you gave it. So that's something where it's like me, as a solo developer, I feel like I could maintain five Nostr apps doing this.
Yeah.
That are very high performance. It's not as high performance as
Do one specific
Will's.
Thing
yeah,
and do it
it's
well.
Not as high performance as Will's thing, but it's also like, you know, he's having to implement GIF renderers.
Yeah.
I don't even understand how my UI is rendered. Like, I don't even...
Yeah, you don't need to care.
I don't care.
You don't need to care.
The computer does it for me, right? Like, it's like a button for me.
Yeah, it's funny to see how this evolves. And should we walk one more around and then, like, grab a coffee?
Yeah.
It's like, I think I can walk again for a little bit. But the... So Pablo also, I spoke about it with him last week. So he is... transforming NDK now, and especially the NDK documentation. So he's producing snippets, basically standalone code examples of how to do one thing and make it like very easily digestible by an LLM.
Yeah.
And just that's the documentation.
So this is another thing I want to do is there's this thing called 7GUIs.
Yeah. It's like, I know it from Paul as well.
Yeah, 7GUIs is like, how do you say it? It's like a benchmark for UI frameworks, right? So it's like the first thing is a counter app. The second app, the second one is
you click the counter and it increments.
Yeah, plus
from
one, down
two,
one, right? Yeah. And then it's a timer, right? Yeah. Which just has to have like some asynchronous thing where you're counting. And then there's like a temperature converter. And the last one is a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And so it's like as I was implementing this, I was going back and forth with LLMs being like, write me the Rust side of it.
Yeah.
And then like, okay. And then I'd say, okay, this would be the data model, right? Like now, write me a UI based on the static data. So I didn't actually write the app, so I was thinking about, like, could this? What would it look like in this paradigm to do the whole 7 GUIs? And eventually I will implement all of them, and that will be my docs, right? So it's like, here's the full GUI benchmark.
Yeah.
And so now you should be able to understand, like you'd give that as context to models and be like, here are examples of apps, right? Like, and you could give it, like, you know, if you had a bunch of little, you know, I make a little eCache vault, make a little, a couple things like that, and those could be the things that, that the LLMs use to kind of as context to generate their code.
I think we'll have to turn around here. Yeah, it's really funny to me to see it evolve and how everyone uses that. And
but
now we're purpose building tools to make it easier for us to work with LLMs going forward.
Yeah,
that's why you are building Rust multi-platform.
Yeah, I mean it's funny too because I'm never the type of person that would work on a framework like that. Just it's not appealing at all.
Yeah.
Like I'm much more of a pragmatist where it's like I have a thing I want.
But you
build.
Are being pragmatic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but this is something where it's like I can't tell if it's just because I'm more mature now as a developer because like especially in Fedi and Fedimint, like that was such a massive project. I learned so much from like you know like there was a time where I had the entire Fedimint thing in my head and I had the entire Fedi thing in my head. Like, I had the whole thing in my head and was watching it for 2 years and learned so much. And so like. That made me like kind of a little more interested. And oftentimes we'd have a problem and we'd build tooling and the problem would go away.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like I think there's part of it is like this is a natural progression
a
developer goes through where you see enough and you're like, damn, certain tools really make your problems go away.
Yeah.
So in a sense, I'm just learning from that experience. But it's also like the LLM where it's like I would have never spent time. You know, I had like 7 structs and stuff that for the first version of this that I did manually, and then I got it down to 3. With a macro, with macros that would generate code for me, and I'm generating all kinds of code just so I can get it maximally simple.
Yeah.
And see if it could work, and that's something I would have never done manually. Like, I've never written a Rust macro because I don't have the sufficient autism. Like, I would always have a guy for that, right? Like,
we should run a vote if people agree. Like after listening to all that, let's see.
But like, no, like I've been doing Rust and I'm pretty good at it. But I've had like almost like a unconscious policy: I will not write a fucking macro.
Yeah.
Like I'm not gonna do it because it's very difficult. This is actually one reason I write Zig. I think Zig is cool. So Rust has this, like the hard macros are like metaprogramming. So it's like programming that generates your program. Right. And it's the hardest type of programming. Like in C, for example, you have two languages. C, the actual runtime language, is pretty simple. Like you can learn it in like a couple days because there's not that many structs. And of course, there's a lifetime of little nuances. But the metaprogramming, like the if def, like if I'm compiling on Mac OS, like inject this code, if not, that's like a whole nother language and it's dog shit compared to C. Like C is a very elegant, kind of amazing language, but it's still the go-to thing for embedded programming, for example, like 50 years later.
Yeah.
It's unbelievably how good and how successful C is.
How well designed.
Yeah, yeah, but the macro language sucks. Yeah. And I would say Rust is not that much better. It's better, but it still sucks. Like it's very, you look at a Rust code and it's not so bad. You look at a macro and it's like, Jesus, there's dollar signs everywhere. It's really confusing. The cool thing about Zig is it has something called comp time where you can just label various variables or functions and that code is executed while your code compiles.
Mm-hmm.
So your metaprogramming is not a second language like it is in C, or a second language like it is in Rust.
Just injects at compile time.
It's the same syntax, but it's just evaluated when your code compiles. And so you can have like a variable, for example, where you evaluate it at comp time. And even in a statically typed language where you have a function, it should only take in a 32-bit integer or a 16-bit integer.
Yeah, I see.
They should be different. You can say comp time, and you can say, hey, at comp time, we'll make separate versions of this function for any type of integer. And so now you have like Python-style duck typing where any sort of int-looking thing can work because at comp time, you basically generate versions for every one of these. So it's like that's one of the really cool things about Zig is the hardest part of programming, metaprogramming, is now just as easy as the normal part of programming. I don't know why I went off on that tangent.
I mean, I knew it would be a sick conversation, so I knew it would be.
But yeah, I think it would be cool in Nostra if we could have more Unix style. And this is one thing that's made me a lot more interested in.
That's actually where it's trending. I really do. I already use different Nostra apps and tools.
Well, it's funny. In a sense, it's trending in the opposite direction on the visible level. Because all the apps are becoming more and more monolithic, like Primal and Amethyst are becoming more and more monolithic.
But I think we have to differentiate.
I think it's becoming bimodal, right?
Yes.
Like you have monolithic apps, and then you're going to have the opposite, and there's going to be no mid curve. I think kind of, right? Like you either have to have the kitchen sink, or you're going to be one off. And the thing is, like the Unix apps on iOS, if you're trying to do this on iOS, like you're kind of neutered because you can't have a You can't have one relay. You actually can. So, like, in general, iOS apps can't talk to each other. Like,
you can't have an on-device relay, is what you mean.
So let me back up. Like, the whole point of Unix tools is that you can pipe them.
Yes.
Right? So the input is text, the output is text, right? So you can, the cat program reads a file and prints it out. And then you can pipe that. You just do the vertical straight up and down character. Yeah. I'm just saying this for the listeners. And then you can pass in the next thing, like grep. Grep searches. So you can get search it for something you're interested in. And then you can use like another sed to replace. So you can read a file, search what's relevant, and then find and replace the part that you want to do, like rename a function name. And so that's the brilliance of like a bunch of little single-purpose tools kind of suck if they can't be composed. But if they can be composed, it's a superpower. And that paradigm still exists 50 or 60 years later from when Unix was invented. And that's what this is one of the two things that Andreas Kling was trying to, put into his operating system. The other one was the Windows things, right? So if you translate this to mobile, the thing you need is for apps to talk to each other.
Yeah.
You need to do input and output between apps. You need to be like a function in a sense, right? At least something like that. Like, I don't think you'll ever get quite to the Unix tools level, but they need to talk to each other.
I mean, that's the whole idea of DVMs and the whole idea of Nostra events in the first place.
Yeah. That can help to some degree, but like, you can't, like, so one thing, you just start from scratch. It's like, okay, I would like to have one app that does signing. Like, I want to prepare an event, and then I want to have another app sign it.
Yeah.
That's very easy on Android. You basically,
Android.
You can't really do it on iOS with one exception that's almost hilarious. And part of me wants to do it just to piss everybody off. You can do it if the apps are from the same app developer. So what I could do is I could make an Apple developer account, and I could have a Unix tool set of iOS apps that can talk to each other only because they're my walled garden. Which, of course,
is it,
everyone...
Is it like every app that's signed by the same developer team?
I think so. That's my understanding, right? So if you saw it, Yeti Project, I forget the guy's name who's doing it, but it's like a signer for iOS. That's the constraint, is that it all has to be... You know, it is a signer that can be used by multiple apps.
What if we use something smart like Frost to share our ultimate signing keys, but have individual?
But potentially,
keys?
So this would be an irony.
Like just a shared like, Noster iOS app signing key.
We could do something like that, yeah. Where we have like the entire Noster ecosystem.
But no one actually owns the key. Yeah, it's just generated from like a thousand keys.
Yeah, like we could have a Noster. Like we would have to set up some kind of legal identity for iOS to accept it.
Yeah.
But like you could, we could have
and have like a pool of a thousand keys.
A federation. We could have a federation, and you'd get. Like the Android user experience. So I've been thinking about doing that. But it does, you know, in lieu of that, you could have a pretty cool, like it makes me much more interested in Android because like these things just work.
Yeah.
You know, so the Unix
tools. It absolutely
tools,
works.
The Unix tools vision is much more achievable on Android.
But that's why I'm saying, like, I'm already using it like that. And I know my mom is never going to use Noster like that. You know, like she's going to default to a kitchen sink client and so on. And that being said, I'm still a huge fan of both primary
or eventually Block will make a phone
sure
that does this out of the box.
But I'm like I run Ember
like
I run
Citrine, realistic
like,
Mass Effect.
I have an on-device relay, I have an on-device signer, you know, I've dedicated apps for various things for various content types and those kind of things.
But like so. Here's the interesting thing with this Rust multi-platform, like if I got it sufficiently good where it's like the thing I was working today is like this week was reproducible builds, right? Like I packaged Xcode, I packaged it so like I could build, it's not quite there, but I could build my app on both platforms reproducibly with a fresh laptop I just bought.
Yeah.
You know, and I can do that same thing, the same build for my dev, the same build for when I produce like an actual APK or something that needs to be like secure. Same exact software setup bit by bit, and what runs in CI, which runs my tests, which gates like whether the code is accepted or not.
Yeah.
So that's not like... Like, if I have all these tools, I'm pretty sure I could build this entire ecosystem myself. Like, literally one guy, like, I would not need any help, and I could build, like, 10 apps. Not the entire ecosystem, but, like, enough where like, there could be a phone, there could be a camera, there could be, like, I feel like I could kind of have the Unix tools of, like, a phone, and, one guy, I think I could actually do all this myself if I had the tools good enough ahead of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the designer wouldn't be that hard because there's like these Rust libraries are really good, right? The relay wouldn't be that good because I'm leading on all these great libraries.
Yeah. But I think the way smarter way would be to figure out how to get around this limitation and share a signing key in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
In some cryptographic way that no single person can rug pull the whole effort. Because I don't believe in doing things.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not saying this that like, I would. Like I wouldn't seriously do this.
I always worry about Pablo because he tries to do all the things himself, basically.
Yeah,
and it's also.
No, but the other thing too is this is another thing that's not necessarily that I would want to do that because I actually don't want to do that. Very much don't want to do that. Don't want to be in charge of all that. But it's like a benchmark, right? Like, could you do it all yourself?
Yeah, that's
fair
enough.
You could, because I'm a smart developer, but I also have limited things I can hold in my head at once, right?
Sure.
If it's simple enough where I can do 10 different things, it's like, well, I know a lot of guys who could just pick up a few of these apps and do them themselves.
Yeah.
There's probably plenty of others who could do this all themselves. So it would make it, in a community context, more maintainable by a group, right? Like if one person could do it all, if you got it simple enough where one person could do 10 apps.
Oh, then it's very simple for any additional person.
Then you don't need one person anymore.
Yeah,
because then share it. Like then you can share the load a lot easier.
Then it can open it up.
But if it's like in order to get started, like this is the problem I confirmed when we first started Fedi. It's like, how the fuck do you put all this fancy ass Rust code into a mobile app, right? Yeah. Like that was very difficult for a month just figuring out how to do this because there isn't good prior art for this.
Yeah,
like there was like two or three GitHub examples I saw that were shitty, and I had to just figure it out. So it's like if all of that was just kind of taken care of for you, where like. And the AI could, you just have to write a little logic, and you have to kind of know Rust, and the AI will write your UI for you. And, you know, at the end of the day, you're using, like, the Rust Noster SDK, you're using libsecp, Rust Wrapper, you're using all these...
The heavy lifting
you're
is done
using CDK,
stuff.
You're using FediMint Client, you're using all these great Rust libraries. Like, I think more stuff becomes possible there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the other option is, like, you know, you just kind of... The version of this now is everyone just writes web apps, but...
Yeah, yeah.
I think the, I don't know, there's something about like a, quote-unquote native app, it just feels so much better in your hand.
It's also, it's like what most of the Nostr developers miss, or many of the Nostr developers miss, like those that are building the web apps, is like 98% of people are on phones.
Yeah.
It's just like, your web app is completely uninteresting. If there isn't an app that people can install, most people are not going to use it.
But I mean, you can install it as a PWA, and like, I think Mutiny showed that you can get a pretty good PWA.
Yeah, you can do that. But
Most people
don't know what it is.
You're kind of jamming a square into a round hole a little bit, right?
But it's like I'm kind of, you know, I'm of two minds with all that stuff, because it's also, I think that the app stores are going to be a massive issue going forward.
This is
as
the other thing that
Android is fantastic because of App Store alone.
Yeah, no, that's the other thing that makes Android so much more appealing. Is like, let's say I did this on iOS. Like, literally, the only way I would do this. Actually, so the idea that one person could do it alone is false, because I could write all the. If you could sideload on app stores on iOS, maybe I could do this.
Yeah.
But without that, like, I would literally kill myself if I had to, like, literally, kill myself if I had to manage 10 different apps. Like, that
just
is
just the code signing alone.
I mean,
is
it's funny. The code sign I could do all in Nix. Like, I can automate all that. The fucking clicking around the
generating the screenshots.
And then like the retarded things the reviewers send back, like. Yeah. It's more of that, like dealing with that person that's different every time and is an idiot and doesn't understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you are probably, you know, going against what they want you to do to some extent.
Yeah, sure.
So I would have to hire somebody to do that.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way I would do that myself. Yeah. I would just crash and burn if I tried to do that.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that's so appealing with App Store is, like, you know, you could get it where it's like, if CI is green, 10 minutes later there's a new...
Yes, absolutely. That's how it works right now.
Yeah, that's really appealing.
Yeah, and you self-sign it.
So, like, distribution is, like, if I kept doing this, like, in principle, I think I could get the distribution story for Zaps for Android to be as good as it is on the web. Because that's the thing. That's actually the thing right now that the web is really good at, is the distribution is so easy.
Yeah.
Like, you can just set up Git hooks to Vercel, and your website shows up when it's done building.
Yeah.
Like, no, like... You push it to GitHub, and as long as
you
it builds,
master and that's it.
It's on.
Yeah,
you know, like,
but SAPSTAR enables this for APKs at least.
But and that's one thing that I, you know, like, I don't think any of us understand how important that is. Like, we don't. Most people don't. Most people don't understand. Even
yeah,
I don't.
Don't
like, I've been thinking about this.
Yeah.
I don't think I appreciate.
Yeah.
Like, every week, I'm like more realizing
super
how
important.
How
yeah.
important that is.
Yeah.
So I don't think I fully understand it, because I did. I'm more bullish on it than I was last week.
Yeah.
And. Last week I was more bullish on it than I was the previous week, so I just project forward. Like, I don't think I understand it quite yet.
And also, with enough tooling, this stuff will be easier and easier and easier. And it's still so underutilized, because App Store is mostly an Android thing now. But also, if I'm downloading Sparrow Wallet or like Bitcoin Core Client or whatever, it's like, I want to make sure that it's signed by the right people and they are part of my web of trust.
Yeah.
I would just want to see it immediately. Yeah. I want to have these checks happen automatically.
Yeah.
And we don't do all that yet. We have like... primitive CLI tools that implement that a little bit and so on, like Francep built some of those and so on. But we don't really, like, and no one stops us from, like, improving up on Homebrew, for example, by 10x.
Yeah.
Like, we can do that. Also, all kinds of package managers and so on. Like, we can improve just by adding Nostr to this layer.
Yeah.
And also SAPs and micropayments.
Yeah.
It's like, it's they even have it in NPM, right? Where it's like, these projects are looking for funding and those kind of things. Like if that's how I use Nostr right now. If I find something amazing, I'm going to SAP it. If it's like an amazing tool, I'm happy to SAP the package straight up.
One thing I'm really interested in trying to do is integrate ZapStore with Nix. So, like, the whole idea of Nix is that you declare what inputs are to a build process. So a build process is like, you have code and you want to turn it into something you can run, right? And this is for the, you know, listeners, right? So you have code, like text in a file, and you want to turn it into a thing you can run on Linux or an APK or something. And, you know, somebody has to build that, right? And so, like, for example... You know, Nix is very similar to Geeks. Geeks, it's the same idea, but a different implementation. Geeks is like more hardcore FOSS type people that don't want
Bitcoin
commercial
Core switched to Geeks like 4 years ago.
Bitcoin Core
right?
uses Geeks, right? Yeah. So the thing is, it allows like a very, very reproducible build where...
With almost zero dependencies.
With almost zero dependencies, right? Like, and for context, right? Like, you know, the old way they did it was Gideon. And so the environment you use to build your new version of Bitcoin Core was Ubuntu. Ubuntu contains like 400 megabytes of trusted binaries.
Yeah.
So like you have 400 megabytes of stuff that could be an
text surface
that could be an inflation bug.
Yeah.
And you don't know. And like it's reproducible, meaning like you put code in, you code plus Ubuntu equals binary. You get the same one every time. But since the inflation bug could be in the Ubuntu and not the code, you might have an inflation bug every time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so Geeks was an attempt. Yeah.
The issue is that you can build a hostile compiler that injects stuff into your things, and it will be almost impossible to detect it. So you have to bootstrap the whole thing out of nothing, knowing every step along the way it does without adding any external dependencies.
The craziest thing that Geeks does is called stage zero. So this is where they start with 200 bytes, I think, 200 bytes of trusted binary. So it's literally like assembly code that's commented saying what each instruction does.
Yeah.
And that is bootstrapped into something that can like interpret a little bit more. And so there's
That's how paranoid those people are.
There's three layers of reading text. And then they write like three layers of scheme compilers, just like the simplest Lisp dialect. And then they build like TCC, it's called. It's like a really primitive basic C compiler. And then they build another one. And then they build GCC, which can build everything. So you have like nine stages to get to a, a real C compiler. And so Nix is the same thing that's not quite as, you can't bootstrap it quite as well, but it's very good in the sense that you declare what do I need to build this software, and then it can just build it without any globally installed stuff, which is where you get all the, you know, problems, both for a developer experience, but also for like building a trusted binary. So what you could do is you could make it so like every time I run a project that contains some of this stuff, I could have like one little command to like build and publish event of what hash the binary was. You know, so stuff like that, right? Mm. So you could have like an extension to Nix where every developer who uses it in their flow, whenever they publish a binary or whenever they run a binary for anything, it can just publish it and something and as an OSTR events. And so you could get sort of like a real web of trust on binaries for free.
Yeah.
You know, and like, not necessarily for free, like someone like Zapstore would have to be, you know, aggregating all this and trying to notice if two people disagreed. But you could see automatically, like, well, did Gigi and Justin ever build Amethyst and get different hashes for a given version?
Yeah.
Right? So like that would be really cool where you could get almost automatically just a normal developer workflow or CI pipeline.
Yeah, now
right?
we have dedicated, you know, like NBK like, built this bot with the
like,
binary.
Let's say, I don't know how Amethyst works, but let's say they publish it via their CI.
Yeah.
Right? Like I could take their code and I could run it in my own CI server.
Yeah.
And you could see whether like my same setup and their setup disagreed or not.
Yeah.
So like I think there could be stuff like that where you could, I think this Zapstra idea, like binaries plus kind of attestation.
I think the meta idea is like you wanna have the trust distributed from multiple sources as much as possible.
Yeah.
You don't want to have a single point of failure, a single source of trust.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is basically you'll have that automatically just because every single developer
I could have a Nix server. I could have a Nix server that just watches 50 GitHub repos.
Yeah.
If they use Nix, or if I think my social network cares, there could be some app that I don't ever want to use.
Yeah. Yeah. But you like, still want to check it.
You know, Jesus's his Jesus and Sandwich's Tamagotchi idea.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I never used that, let's say.
Yeah.
But maybe I think my followers might be interested. So I could set up basically a CI server. It's kind of like CI, but like a server that watches 49 GitHubs that I care about, plus that one. Whenever there's a new thing, whenever a new release branch, whenever a new release is published, I download the code. It just does a Nix build. It's all automated. With no real coding effort on my part, and it just publishes what hash I got.
Yeah.
And so you could get, how Nix currently works is there's like, there's a big package registry that's on GitHub, and I think they basically have one server, like this Hydra server, that builds stuff and publishes it, and says those are what the real hashes are, right? Like, I don't understand it very well, but I think that's basically how it works. So it's like, you do, in the Nix ecosystem, you are kind of trusting. I'm sure there are other people checking each other, but it's not. It's very like centralized in the sense that there's not more than 100 of these.
Yeah. You know? I mean that's the name of the game. We don't want to remove trust entirely. We just want to remove trusted third parties as much as possible.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, like I'm still trusting my web of trust that they're not malicious and not pushing malicious binaries and all those kind of things. But it's just it's always better to have, I believe, to have multiple sources and kind of like crowdsource this stuff and just kind of, like have a balance that keeps everyone in check. Right now also with the app stores, for example, there's one instance. If they want to remove you from the app store, you're done.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Like, you don't have any checks and balances or anything like that. And should we do one more like up and down and then grab a coffee? I'll need some drugs very soon.
Yeah.
The heat stroke hits and I'm still half sick and limping.
Well, that's a nice day. It's not raining. It hasn't rained yet.
Oh, yeah. That was something I never factored into the, you know, let's just go on a walk and have a conversation kind of thing. It's like, what if it starts raining? What if there's like, you know.
Yeah. Like, I really should have brought like a raincoat. I did zero research. And I get here and we're going on these walks and stuff. And I'm like, oh, shit.
Yeah, it's unusually
rainy. All I did was I looked on a map and I said, okay, it's off Morocco. This is going to be like a beach town. This is gonna be. I brought the flip flops. You know, this is gonna be like. I didn't even look at the weather. No, it's like 80 degrees every day.
But it was winter right now, basically. So it's really like unusually cold and rainy. And oh man, it was so windy last time with Pablo. Like a bus stop flew away, and like it was it was mayhem. It was like hurricane level wind.
Yeah.
So very very unusual weather. But to me, it's super exciting to watch kind of the culmination of so many things and strains of thought. And it's all kind of culminating now in the Noster eCash world in some sense. It's like, because a lot of the, I talked with Kelly about this briefly, a lot of the Chaos Computer Club hacker scene, Berlin type people, they really love eCash. Yeah. They hate Bitcoin, but they love eCash. They know it's the right idea. Lots of the AI people, they know they need micropayments.
Yeah.
Some of the zero knowledge compute people and so on, they figure out now Noster is the perfect substrate to do stuff. Not a new shitcoin, not a new whatever other thing. And for communication and like SimpleX and all those kind of things as well, it's like you need a substrate that does the social lookup that initiates the handshake, for example. You know? Yeah. So it's like you said with your phone and NPUB idea, you need to hole punch to something.
Yeah.
And it might as well be an NPUB.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to build up a new layer of.
Well, the whole point of building a phone, like the phone, building a phone calling app is like the worst idea possible normally, because it's like, how the fuck am I going to get another phone number? Like, you know, that's not, like, I can't, you know.
Maybe phone numbers are massive shit codes.
But like, so whatever the analog is, what you're doing, it's like you're looking at such a monumental effort to develop a contact book of people you could interact with.
Yeah.
But with Noster, you get it for free.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of funny that I got interested in this, because it's like the worst idea normally, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it provides a lot of things for free. And I think also
And this calling thing isn't like one of the apps that the Bitcoin world has produced that has, I think, one of the best user experiences is Keet.
Right? Yeah, Keet is good.
Keet has
no one really knows how it works.
For some things, like you get on a call, I've been on a few video calls where it's like, this has better latency than Zoom.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the call is higher quality than Zoom.
Yeah.
What's going on here, right?
Because it's direct and you both have good connections.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but then there's some downsides, right? Like no one knows how it works. It's not open source, which is to me extraordinarily suspect in a security focused app from a company with a money printer.
Yeah.
Like a literal money printer.
Yeah.
Like very suspect. And, you know, I went and looked at the binary to try to understand how it works, and it's like they do all this obfuscation to hide where the code is, right? Like the actual source code is in a platform.mp3 file.
MP3?
MP3. It's an MP3 file. So I had to, the crazy thing is I was asking one of the LLMs about this stuff, and it actually knew about the platform.mp3 file from a Chinese forum. There's a Chinese so forum. I wouldn't go. I had like an hour conversation. I was trying to get the LLM to tell me how it knew that, because it was O1 Pro, and like O1 Pro, it's hard to get it to answer direct questions. So, you know, because it has bad social skills.
Yeah.
He has bad social skills, as I mentioned. But somehow it knew this, so I was able to get in there, and it's like, so they have this thing called Hyperdrive, which is a way of like having like, it's like a file. It's like a file system mounted on the DHT. And this is where like the UI components are saved. So the UI components are in like a binary format in their DHT file system. That's how it is.
That's interesting.
Which is like, what are you hiding here? You know, and then the identity is something, I don't even know how, you have to just do it all from scratch. So that's where Noster comes in. It's like, well, if you could just add, even if you kept all the, and it's WebRTC, if you just kept all the technical stuff and just added Nostr Identities, I think it would be, at least for my social group, it would be better.
Yeah.
Because then I could call you. Yeah. I can't call you on Keep because I don't. Yeah. We'd have to do some out of band thing.
Yeah.
But if it was, if you had Nostr Identities, I could call you directly.
Yeah.
And. But yeah, then this
and that's in the end always what you want to do, right? Like you want to send money to someone, you want to call someone, you want to send a message to someone, you want to tag someone, you want to basically. I often just want to go like, hey, I think this article would be interesting for you. I just want to tag people in articles and just like, hey, like that's I suggest you read it.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily want to DM you the link. That's kind of, you know what I mean?
It's
We are evolving all these different levels and layers now. It's like I definitely don't want to send you an email with like, hey, dear Justin.
I mean, that's another one that would be like a Unix thing that would be interesting. It's like they're just the notifications that you want to get in their notifications tab.
Yeah.
But like you don't necessarily, I don't necessarily want my
It's like
my Twitter feed.
Tiny
app.
Thought, take it or leave it.
Yeah, well,
I'm not mad if you're not.
But I don't necessarily want to see like long form stuff. Like to me, the long form world should be like a separate world. Like,
I agree. I completely
I'm in a
agree.
Totally different mind space.
I completely agree.
When
I
I'm using like an RSS reader versus Twitter.
I still
Twitter.
Hate kind of the fact that, first of all, Twitter removed the character limit. Second of all, Nostr didn't reintroduce the character limit for kind ones.
Yeah.
I think kind ones should be tweets and they should be short.
Yeah.
And a long form is something completely different.
But that's a good example in the kind of the monolithization of Nostr, right? Like it's like the clients are becoming everything and everything is in these clients and it's like it'd be...
But I'm already using DBMs on clients that hide long form stuff. It's like I use the you know, I did bipoding
before. But this is
bimodal.
You're
cool.
On this one weird...
I know, I'm left side of the bell curve, kind of, you know, I want to use the stupidest tools imaginable.
Yeah.
And so I vibe coded the DVM into existence with like, someone build a DVM that only shows tweets that are shorter than 210 characters, basically.
Yeah.
And I use it all the time because I don't want to read walls of text when I scroll through my feed.
Yeah.
It's like, limitation is what fosters creativity and limitation is what made Twitter great, I think.
Yeah.
But I think we will have this specialization. It's like, you know, a live stream and like a comment in a chat of a live stream is different than a tweet.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different thing. It's a different interaction.
Yeah.
It's like a highlight of a long form article or margin notes in a book are a different thing than a tweet.
Yeah.
And the kind of this conversation / war is currently going on because people obviously have different opinions on it. Like what should be a kind one and what shouldn't and so on. And how should we render it? Because Pablo has a great point that you should make it at least discoverable, that this stuff exists on Nostr, so it should pop up in your kind one feed from time to time. In a sense, like, you know, like this is a highlight, but your client right now cannot really render highlights, for example, and all those kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll figure it out. All right, coffee?
Yeah.
Any more Zig thoughts?
No. No. It's a distant memory.
You're back.
A nightmare. It was sick, but a nightmare.
The sick developer who's building Rust multi-platform.
Yeah, I'm gonna go build some web apps now.
Let's do it.
After all this GigaBrain thing, I'm gonna go build web apps that aren't responsive.
You're gonna just speak into a mic.
Desktop only.
Code React Native into existence. Something like that. Yeah, awesome. No, let's close it here.
Okay.
I think that was great. I'm a little bit dizzy, but it's just me being sick. So let me give you a hug.
Oh.
And I forgot to do the snap in the beginning, so I'll have to do that now. Because otherwise I have no way to sync it up if we fucked up. And it might be the first recording that we have actually as an MP3 file from the get-go.
Okay.
I think it's the first time after 8 tries or so, or 9 tries now, that I got it right.
What do you
mean? But we'll find out. I always press I forget to press record on the phone, or the cable breaks, or it always fucked it up.
Where's the cable? That thing. Oh, so it's like a receiver.
Yeah, so it's still working. And it switched the input source sometimes. Wow. That might be a graphene thing, I don't know, and then it just recorded my pocket. So it's all right.
That's a good one.
Fantastic.